John McCain, thighs for days.
What?
That was an inside joke.
Jesus.
Between me and my wife.
Whoa.
Years ago. Like, it was back in the 2008 election, of course, he was running. And I think I misheard her. And I thought she said, John McCain, thighs for days. And I said, that's weird. Why would you say it about John McCain? And she's like, no, I said, whatever. Now, every once in a while, we're just like, John McCain, thighs for days.
John McCain, dies for days.
Thighs for days.
Thighs for days. Oh, I thought you said dies for days. No. I was like, that's dark.
Yeah, that's horrible. Yeah. No, thighs for days.
That's way better. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Storage Room Movie Boom. I'm Eden.
I'm Sam.
This is the podcast where two adult siblings talk about movies in their parents' basement.
Show is.
We were just referencing how safe we are in this basement versus everyone that's out at college football games.
Yeah, man, we are much more secure down here.
From COVID, I guess we should say.
Well, I mean, you'd think overall, right?
Or murderers. Speaking of this week.
I mean, who's going to break into a basement at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday?
Well, you remember from Scream 1, he was like running around in the daylight in somebody's lawn. The most hilarious scene. In that whole movie.
There's only one of those like that in this movie where it's just kind of nonsensical, silly.
Oh, there's some silly stuff.
Nonsensical, silly stuff here, but
right.
In terms of just the guy in the mask running
sure.
around.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, we'll there are a couple of pratfalls and I was like, oh, they stuck with that. Got it.
Yeah.
So what we're referencing, of course, is Scream 2, which we'll be talking about this week. In case anybody is tuning in for the second Scream movie as your first episode. Weird, but okay. Let's set this up for you. Every week we pitch three movies. One of us pitches to the other. We select a movie. That's what we watch the following week. If we select a movie that is the first of a series, we have to watch that series. Sam, a couple weeks ago, chose the movie Scream. So we're watching Scream 1, 2, and 3.
Yep.
Omitting number 4 because we didn't know it existed and it doesn't seem to be connected.
Yeah, it's the way after sequel that to, you know, try and find more money.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. They're like, we haven't really rung this bell in a while.
Exactly.
So because we know what we're going to watch week to week whenever we do one of these spinoff series, to maintain the pitch portion of the segment, we have been pitching to each other a little amuse-bouche, a short episode of TV to watch along with the movie. Sam pitched to me three episodes last week. Sam, what were those?
Those were an episode of Lizzie McGuire, an episode of X-Men Evolution, and an episode of the early 2000s show Dark Angel.
That's right.
Yeah, well, my theme was obviously things that referenced Scream or other 90s, you know, paraphernalia, because Scream is one of the most 90s movies there is. And this one might actually have it beat.
I think it does because they reference 90s
yeah.
a couple of times.
Yeah, this one is. There's also more cameos from uber 90s personalities.
Oh my God.
This one really doubles down on the whole aesthetic.
Truly, before, I'm so excited to talk about the cameos. My notes have so many capital letters in it. It's great.
Yeah.
But what I think we're going to do, so last week, Sam pitched those three episodes of TV. I ended up choosing X-Men Evolution, season 2, episode 13, which was called Walk on the Wild Side.
Yeah, and I was so glad. I didn't want to watch Lizzie McGuire.
I very much enjoyed this episode. So what we're going to do is I'm going to set a timer for 5 minutes. We are going to attempt to talk about this 22-minute episode for 5 minutes, and then bam, we're going to get to Scream 2.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay.
Okay, so we actually are going to try and hold ourselves to it. This is one of Sam's favorite series, and he's got a lot to say and actually have a lot of questions.
Yeah.
All right. And go.
All right, so right off the top of the bat, I have to say that the first person you see in this episode is Cyclops,
yes.
who is voiced by Kirby Morrow in
yep.
this series.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away suddenly last year. He was in his early 50s. They never said why. I don't
Sad.
Think it was COVID. So right off the top of the bat, I have to say RIP Kirby Morrow.
RIP.
He was also several other animated characters at the time, including Troll Barton from the dub of Gundam Wing, which was also one of my very favorites.
Nice.
So. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, the last two times we've talked about X-Men, I've had to talk about Cyclops dying in real life, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, but that's right.
That's one of the things that, you know, I wanted to say off the top.
Well, RIP, he did a great job I love the voice actors in this, because I did look them up briefly, and I know that you are far more versed in that world and more familiar with those actors. I did notice that they were almost all Canadian.
Yeah, that was not at all uncommon in the 90s and early 2000s to use Canadian voice talent.
Well, I was going to ask if this show was produced in Canada.
I'm sure they was. I'm sure
that
the majority
would make sense to me.
Shows from our childhood and, you know, early college years would have been produced in Canada.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's not. It was, of course, because of cost.
Sure.
It's cheaper, or at least back then, to do it in Canada. Nowadays, not so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was definitely a commonality.
Got it. That makes sense. Always looking for that dollar. So the episode starts out.
Yeah, this is a very straightforward episode. It's very much a girl power episode.
Sure.
Nothing
is
wrong with that. Jean gets into a little tiff with Cyclops because
toxic masculinity.
I don't know that I'd say toxic, but it's very much
toxic masculinity.
I don't define it as such here, but yeah, she's very much just doesn't want a guy to come around all the time to, you know, tell her what to think or to save her ass or what have you.
Yes.
And so her and the character Magma, essentially gather up a bunch of the other female mutant characters, and they form a kind of vigilante group. You know, just fighting crime during the night, called the Bayville Sirens.
Do you know what I called them?
No.
The Tough Women Ass Kicking Team, or TWAT. Because I wrote it down, I go, oh, TWAT.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Very, very progressive.
I'm taking that back, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way whatsoever. That's my word. I can fucking use it. Actually, anybody could use it. It's a fun word. So I had a couple of questions about this. One, before we, I don't want to get into the weeds about it, but I was not familiar with Magma. I was not familiar with Boom Boom.
Yep.
So a couple of these characters, me just knowing, you know, the brief amount of 90s X-Men information, and then obviously the movies from the 2000s. But so were these like, and then obviously I recognize Kitty Pryde, but like, yeah, a couple of those characters, are they legit or were they created for the series?
No, they were legit. They were from the New Mutants back in the 80s when they were created. And then in the 90s, they were both, or at least one of, Boom Boom was in X-Force.
Okay.
And I forget where Magma went during the 90s. I think she wasn't used very much. But yeah, they're definitely classic characters.
Gotta say, perhaps there are other, like, less predominant male characters that are also fall under this category. But as far as Boom Boom's mutant ability,
yeah,
just seemed like a different version of Jubilee's stupid little fireworks. It was like I was like, give her something.
Creates little
cooler.
Explosive balls, and she can of course make them larger and you know, one thing or another. But
she also speaks and looks like a 42-year-old housewife. Like
the voice was rather weird,
and also just kind of her demeanor in it. And I didn't really understand, because are they all supposed to be in high school?
This was a weird show, and we're gonna blow out 5 minutes, but I have to explain it.
Okay,
to you.
Got it.
Because they sent most of them back to high school. Like, in terms of the main characters, the majority of them are in high school. Wolverine and Storm are not in high school. They are kind of the elder statesmen of the school, along with Professor X. But everyone else is high school age.
Is this Professor X's high school, or is this a public high school?
It's a public high school. The Institute is a separate building where they live, but they go to school in a public school there in Bayville.
Is everyone at the public school a mutant?
No, but they do definitely have their, you know, X-Men clique. And then obviously they showed several houses or shots of the rundown.
Yeah, sure.
Brotherhood house. Blob, Toad, Boom Boom, Richter. Richter.
Oh, Blob.
Avalanche.
I was thinking it was Juggernaut. Sorry. Yep.
No, Juggernaut is in this series, but that's not him.
Got it.
So, yeah, that was kind of the main dichotomy. You had the good side and the bad kids, obviously living in very different living conditions.
Yeah, derelict house. So I was confused about all of them being in high school, whether or not it was a public high school, if they were out as mutants or not, because it seemed like they were just like, yeah, doing their thing, even if they weren't performing their. Well, then.
I knew we were going to blow out 5 minutes. We're going to have to go with it. I'm sorry. There's too much to talk about with this show.
There is. We don't have to go B for B. Let's talk about the thing that you sent me, the thing that you wanted me to look for in this episode.
Yeah, the main reason I chose this episode, as soon as they form the sirens, there is a several minute long musical montage. It is so early 2000s.
So.
But it's the girls. They're kind of going, for lack of a better term, being liberated.
Yeah. Which, you know, means shopping and trying on clothes.
Exactly. And dancing in public.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of girl on girl grinding, too, and a lot of butt shots.
So we're going to.
Yep.
There's several things that I want to say about this sequence from a visual perspective. Mm-hmm. One, and I just learned this last night reading just comments about the thing. The animators referenced movies and other shows for the characters' dancing choreography. So Tabitha's dance was from Never Been Kissed, the Jessica Alba vehicle. Jean and Amara's, or Magma, was from Coyote Ugly.
Wait, Never Been Kissed? I thought it was Drew Barrymore.
Well, whatever. I think she may have been in there.
Oh, got it.
Anyway, it was from that movie.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. And I may have just gotten confused.
Anyway.
But it was the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Jean and Amara, their dance was from Coyote Ugly.
Oh, of course. That's why they were grinding on each other.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then apparently there was another dance scene, not in this episode, between Rogue and Shadowcat that was taken essentially from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So that's why those sequences are much better animated, because they had a live, they basically went a one-to-one transfer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it was rotoscope, but it's essentially the same effect.
Right.
And
yeah, because it seemed very particular. I mean, because you just told me last week, you're like, watch out for something.
Yes.
You'll know it when you see it. And I was like, okay. And then as soon as the montage started, I was like, what is this?
So right after that montage, or during the very tail end, there is a shot of the girls walking through the high school hall. And it's a lot of different shots, slow-mo shots of them, and then crowd shots.
Yeah.
And then so that the shots of them, the girls, were taken one-to-one from The Craft, the 1996 movie.
Yes, it was 96, yeah.
I remember you watching it a few times at least.
Mm-hmm.
And just in case it wasn't clear, I had sent you a link.
You did, yeah.
That someone on the internet went and compiled them side by side, the frames, and they match up exactly.
It's one-to-one, it's perfect. So like when that came up, first off, it fit well to wrap up the cheesy montage that they had.
Oh, yeah.
But also, my other thought was, drawing slow motion in 2D animation looks very silly.
It was quite awkward.
It was a little like, are they moving in slow-mo? You know, I mean, you
almost needed a visual effect to highlight it more, because otherwise it just looks like they're going really
almost
slow.
Like the but in an uncool way.
Right.
So you're right. And then I saw that you sent me last night the shot for shot, which I thought was great.
Yep.
Also, side note, in The Craft from 1996, both Nev Campbell and Skeeve Ulrich.
Well, there we go.
Connecting us to Scream.
And I like how you use Skeeve and not Skeet.
His name will now be Skeeve moving forward.
I got it.
In all of my notes, I don't obviously reference him a ton in this movie because he was...
he's name dropped in that.
He's name dropped, and I call him Skeeve because I can no longer unhear that because it's very accurate.
Yeah.
So the TWAT team, they help...
break up a car theft ring. Yeah, in a chop shop.
Thanks to Mystique, who is, I guess, not in high school.
No, she was the principal of the high school throughout the first season and maybe later.
What a fucking weird series.
It was so strange. I like it.
Yeah.
But it was weird. It was one of the more unique Marvel offerings.
I definitely enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun to watch. It was very funny. I mean, I wrote down a bunch of notes that we will not get
and
to.
And there were so many cargo pants.
So many cargo pants. It was just very funny. I like that Cyclops and Jean Grey are cheersing over milk and cookies at the end. I was like, this is so silly.
Yeah.
Also, I did like, just to know one scene, when the TWAT team goes out at night to be, you know, vigilantes and to solve crime and save people. They go out the gate and Cyclops and Nightcrawler are waiting only maybe 30 feet to the left in a car.
Exactly.
And they go out and they're like, duck down. So they duck down in a convertible.
It's a highly distinctive. It's Cyclops's car.
Right. And the girls walk out. Jean Grey pauses and looks to the left. And I go, Cyclops, A, did you think she couldn't see you because you're right next to the gate? You're in a distinctive car and she's fucking psychic. Guys, this is supposed to be his girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
What a dumb dummy. Cyclops is probably one of my least favorite X-Men.
Oh, see, he is my absolute favorite X-Men.
Okay, is Leonardo also your favorite?
No, Raphael.
Mine too.
It used to be Michelangelo back in the day, but now it's Raphael.
Yeah, Raphael's my favorite. Angry adults. Okay,
yeah.
Last final thought on this, and then let's get to the movie.
Yeah, it's just a fun. It was a nice palate cleanser. I watched the episode after Scream 2.
Mm-hmm.
But just a very nice episode, self-contained, you know, very positive message. You know, the girls kind of, again, to use the phrase, get liberated. Cyclops learns a lesson about not always, you know, jumping in where he's not necessarily wanted.
Exactly.
And yeah, it was just very nice.
It was great. I enjoyed it. I watched it this morning at like 7:30. So
Saturday morning cartoons.
I know. That's what I was thinking. I was like, this is perfect. Saturday morning cartoons. This is great. All right. Well, we'll play a little musical bit here. And now let's get on to Scream 2. I am going to hit the fact sheet. How about that?
Sure.
Scream 2 was released December 10th, 1997. It is exactly 2 hours long. Once again, directed by Wes Craven. Once again, written by Kevin Williamson. Our synopsis from MIDB. MIDB?
MIBD.
The
or MIDB.
Maybe index of databasing things.
It might be the internet database.
There you go. Thank you. 2 years after the first series of murders, as Sydney acclimates to college life, someone donning the ghost face costume begins a string of new killings. Accurate.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is.
On Rotten Tomatoes, our favorite website, this film has an approval rating of 81% based on 79 reviews with an audience score of 57.
Yeah, I don't know. It is what it is.
Metacritic gave it 63, which is about right for Metacritic. So yeah. Again, this is one of the ones, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised by this because we've had a handful of these now that we've done. This is episode, I believe, 21, where the audience rating is lower than the critical rating.
Right.
And I think I could see why, because there is, it's an enjoyable film. I liked it. Before we get into it, I would say that there's probably a lot of technical stuff that critics are looking at versus what audience members are probably like, we've seen this before.
Yeah, but it's really weird, though, when you see a critical score for a movie like this, which is really just kind of a schlocky thing to get teenagers into the theater and spend money, to score higher or to have a higher aggregate than the audience.
Right, because I think, and honestly, I don't have it pulled up, but I think that was probably the case last week, or they were both pretty high. But I could see it last week, as we talked about with the first one being so kind of groundbreaking and revitalizing to the genre. I could see critics really like pumped up for that.
Yeah.
And then audiences really being, you know, into it as well, because it was super fun and new and fresh. So yeah, it's a little surprising for this that it only got 57%. Kind of
but
a
again,
bummer.
This was also pre, you know, this type of aggregate, which was it was never designed or
correct,
you know, to be reviewed or aggregated in such a manner.
Totally.
So I don't know how much stock I put into either one of those numbers.
All right. The cast. So this is going to blow out of the water. I don't know if I'm wondering if we want to reveal some of the cameos as we go through it.
As we go through it.
Okay. So just the main cast. We already know David Arquette. Again, once again, got top billing.
That's so weird.
So strange. Nev Campbell, Courtney Cox returns. Jamie Kennedy returns. And I think that is it for the returning characters.
Yeah, just
Once again, Roger Jackson is the voice of Ghostface.
Okay.
So those are our returning characters. They survived the first movie. You know what I heard from Miscellany?
Miscellany. Yeah,
she's got a couple of things to say this week. So let's see what Miscellany wrote to me. Williamson, Kevin Williamson, had been contracted for two potential sequels to Scream when selling the script for the original, based on a 5-page proposal he attached to the script, hoping to entice prospective buyers with the fact that they were not just buying a film, but instead a franchise. Dimension Films agreed to pursue the sequel in March 1997, by which point Williamson had already had 42 pages of the plot developed, which involved 4 different killers. Derek, Hallie, Cotton Weary, and Mrs. Loomis, who is the mother of one of the previous film's killers. By July 1997, filming began on Scream 2, but after Williamson transferred his script to the production company, it was leaked on the internet, which I was like, whoa, the internet, 1997, look at you.
Yeah, there you go, internet, stealing stuff, and like, you know.
Exactly.
Like
so that script at that time, it revealed the identity of the killers and obviously a large amount of the plot. This resulted in the production continuing to film with only a partial script while Williamson conducted extensive rewrites, changing much of the film's finale, the identities of the film's killers, and drastically altering the roles of other such characters such as Randy, Meeks, and Joel.
You can tell. You can absolutely tell that this was rewritten.
Who was Randy again? Oh, Randy is Jamie Kennedy.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Joel, who is the new camera operator. It does seem weird because you're like, is this guy in it? Is he not in it? Do we care about him? Do we not care about him?
They're trying to give
him
a lot of personality, even if it's the stereotypical sassy black guy.
It is. Yeah. Actually, I have a lot to say about stereotypes and race in this movie. So.
Yeah. There's a lot. going on.
Yeah. Some very interesting. We'll get to that. So a couple of the other things that Miss Lanny wrote me, various titles were again considered for the sequel, including Scream Again, Scream Louder, and Scream : The Sequel.
I think Scream Louder would have been okay.
Scream Louder is pretty cool. Scream Again sounds stupid.
Yeah.
Scream the sequel's a little dumb. Yeah. Scream Louder would have been good. Much in the vein of Faster and Furiouser and things like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In one scene, Kevin Williamson's screenplay was described simply as, quote, Wes Craven will make it scary. So a lot of confidence in his director.
Yeah.
As I noted last week, while we were watching this, there was a line in which Sydney is talking to Rose McGowan and she's like, oh, who do you think's going to play? And she goes, ugh, with any luck, it'll be Tori Spelling. And I said in the episode last week, I was like, I was like, there's something about this line that's ringing for me, but I can't quite figure out what it is. I'm supposed to know something. Well, the thing I was supposed to know is that that comes to fruition in this movie.
Right.
So they were quite cheeky, which is really just the theme of this movie.
At times. It's an interesting movie.
It is an interesting movie. So anyway, yeah. So that comes to fruition in this. Randy, who is Jamie Kennedy, his reference to the fake nude pictures of Gail Weathers on the internet was inspired by fake images of Courtney Cox that appeared on the World Wide Web prior to production of this movie.
Yep, probably and in like, you know, 680 or 480i or something, right. Whatever miserable resolution our computer monitors
some
were at in 1997.
Photoshop.
At that point, it was probably like PageMaker or something. I don't even know if it was Photoshop.
It was Microsoft Paint. So Chief Hartley in this movie is Louis Arquette, who's the real life father of David Arquette. They were dating. Courtney Cox and David Arquette were dating during this movie, having met on the first one, but they didn't get married until 1999.
Those two just don't look at all physically compatible. Oh, but at the same time, I don't think anybody looks to be physically compatible with David Arquette.
He's just such a goofy motherfucker.
He is a weird looking person.
So I obviously I put together this fact sheet and then forgot to look at it before this movie.
Skimmed.
Most of the outdoor scenes were filmed at Agnes Scott here in Decatur, Georgia.
Yeah. The funny thing is at the end of the movie, you know, I was just letting the credits roll while I was taking some final notes. And in the special thanks section, they mentioned someone named Mary Zimnick. She was my teacher at Emory for when I was doing graphic design 13 years ago. Yeah, she had been doing work with Agnes Scott for years.
Oh, that's cool.
So I'm assuming that she did something with the movie crew or did some assistance.
Cool.
So there you go. I met a lady who was mentioned in the credits of the movie.
Wow, that's fun.
And I knew the name sounded familiar. I said, Mary Zimnick, who the hell? And I looked her up and I said, oh, right. Yeah, I took classes with
her.
Good eye,
man. Yeah. So as we'll get to it, all of this movie takes place on a college campus. And I kept looking at it and I was like, where the fuck is this supposed to be? Because it doesn't look like we assumed last week that they were in Northern California.
Right.
Because this doesn't look like Northern California.
Not at
all.
And
in fact, it makes fucking sense that it looks like it's in Georgia.
Yeah.
Early in the film, Randy, Jamie Kennedy, and a classmate are having a discussion about sequels and Aliens comes up. Joshua Jackson says Ripley's line correctly, which is, quote, get away from her, you bitch. While Randy corrects him and says it's stay away from her, you bitch. The classmate is indeed correct, but the script called for him to say Randy's line instead. Jamie Kennedy ad-libbed and covered up the mistake.
Yeah. I wonder how much of Jamie's dialogue in this was ad-libbed.
Yeah, it's a good question. They say fuck a lot in this.
Yeah, they didn't really do it so much in the first movie.
No, they didn't, which I enjoyed, but I also noted it, I think.
It was enough to where it was a talking point.
Yeah,
you
for
definitely
sure.
notice it watching the two back to back.
Very
like this.
Distinct from the first one.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's almost like they needed to get it more R. Because like we mentioned last week, the first one with some creative editing could easily be aired on TV.
Yeah, for sure.
This one, not from a violence or gore standpoint, but definitely a language standpoint. You'd have to insert more of those weird TV flubs like Monkey Fighter or whatever other word you want to dub over motherfucker or something like that.
Monkey
with.
Fighter.
I think that's what they did with Snakes on a Plane.
Oh my God.
It's one of the famous dubs.
That's
is
very funny.
I want these monkey fighting snakes off this monkey fighting plane.
Shut up. Really?
I think so.
Who would even attempt to put that movie on television?
I don't know, but somebody did.
That's great. That is great. All right. Well, let's get into it.
Yes, let's.
Let's. There's a cold open.
Yeah.
In our cold open, we are at the movies. The movie is Stab, based on the book written by Gail Weathers.
Yeah.
We're following our couple. who is not breaking stereotypes as far as being the unfortunate black couple in a horror movie. Because
I wish the movie was about them. They have so much charm and personality. It's Jada Pinkett and Omar Epps.
Absolutely. They're so charming together. I love the conversation as they're waiting to get up to the ticket window.
Yep.
Like, she's just so great. And like, he's great as well. And it's just, I fucking love them together.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. Awesome.
Yeah, so she has a great conversation about the reflection of, you know, status of black actors in horror movies. And obviously, you know what's going to come. But yeah, it's great. I love the intense marketing of this movie because they hand everybody ghost face costumes and glow in the dark knives, which is, I just really got to say, I was just like, I've had a long fucking week and I had a couple of drinks before I watched this. I was fucking loving the meta nature of this cold open.
Yeah, there's so much going on here. And it's like everyone's wearing the costume and running around the theater. And in the theater, they're like going crazy, almost like a Muppets production where they're just like throwing popcorn and screaming.
It's
and
wild. There's
running
so
around.
Much going on. It's like a Where's Waldo of Ghostface.
So I was wondering, did any theater ever actually do an over the top event like this? The only thing I can think of, and I never went, I think you may have, was the old Merchants Walk Theater, not the new rebuild, but the original where it was the red brick.
Yeah.
They would have
Did they get rid of that?
They tore down the building and rebuilt it. Now it's like a really nice Merchants Walk. You've been down there.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
But on the other side of that Marlowe's restaurant?
It used to be,
I haven't
remember
been
it used to be red brick like 20 years ago. Uh-huh. Yeah, they tore down the building, but then they rebuilt it. And now it's a nice, modern, very populated movie theater.
I don't think that I've been there since then, dude.
Oh, well, it's very nice. If you see a movie anytime soon around this area, go over there.
Okay.
So I remember prior to that whole area getting redone, as it were, they would have showings of Rocky Horror Picture Show. And they would like do the different stamps based on whether or not you'd seen the movie or not, or one thing or another. But I don't know that it ever went beyond that. And you can explain the whole process because I never went.
Well,
I just heard about it.
I'll tell you this, that I guess me not knowing this, because I think it was either in college or high school when I did go to that. It was a midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show. I'd seen the movie before, but now had not seen it in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize it was a fucking theater fucking nerd fest. It was truly the worst thing that I may have ever experienced. And that includes knocking out all of my teeth. It was so annoying. It was not fun to me. Like, if you're a theater kid, it's the best time of your whole life. It's a super interactive. It's, I don't know. I just was not expecting it. Was just there to watch a fucking movie. Kind of like in this scene, you know, the audience is, it's kind of fun to see those movies where everybody's like laughing and yelling and really engaged. And there's like a whole atmosphere of excitement around, and it's a really active viewing. Fucking watching Rocky Horror Picture Show is stupid. They like, it's it's so dumb. There's a lot of like asking questions and doing a lot of fucking theater work. I don't know. Go fuck yourself, kids. Like, come on.
To be fair, I don't think they do that anymore. So that's a relic.
Oh, well, not at this theater. They do it at the Plaza. I think this is a thing that every midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show is this nerdy ass sort of thing. It also happens at midnight showings of The Room. If you've ever seen The Room.
No, but I know it.
Yeah. So there's a very infamous scene of them horribly throwing a football. So people go in and like throw a football in the theater. And I'm like, come on. Like, let's just go in, enjoy the terribleness of that movie. We'll laugh about it. And it doesn't have to be so schlocky.
Right.
Rant over. So anyway, we're in this really great scene. The theater is just like so kinetic. There's a ton of shit.
It's absolute pandemonium.
Truly is. So they sit down at the seats. The movie starts. Jada is, like myself, a scaredy cat. She's like, oh, I'm very uncomfortable. I don't want to watch this. This is very scary. One of my favorite lines is she goes, give me some money. I need to go get some popcorn. He goes, you got money? And she goes, I asked for your money. I was like, that's fucking right. You did. Should be noted that they show scenes in the movie Stab, which stars Heather Graham.
Playing Drew Barrymore. I can see it aside from their height discrepancy.
Totally. Same bad wig.
Yeah.
It obviously is like just a shade off of what we see in the first movie.
Right.
It's really almost a one-to-one. There's a lot of the same shots, her crawling underneath windows. There's a popcorn shot.
They even play Red Right Hand in the theater before the movie starts.
They absolutely do. And that movie, that footage for the movie Stab, the movie within a movie, is shot by Robert Rodriguez.
Okay.
So, I mean, really, He basically had a paint by numbers for that.
Right. I mean, there's none of that Rodriguez flair.
No, not at all. But I did think that that was interesting because he was approached to direct the first one and Kevin Williamson didn't think that he quite got it.
Right.
But they brought him back for this. So as they're watching that, and that's really fun, watching something that's referencing a real life movie that we already saw. It's all very meta. It's meta on top of meta on top of meta. I love that Jada yells, hang up and dial *69.
That's exactly what I mentioned last week.
Yes, I know. When she did that, I was like, fucking, yeah.
I had seen this movie before, mm-hmm. but I didn't remember all the details. And
same.
I don't know whether or not that line had subconsciously planted itself mm-hmm. in my mind or if it had just, I just thought of it while watching it last week.
It just makes fucking sense.
I said, oh yeah, *69, the guy, you'll find it out.
Yeah, so it's a real bummer that Jada shows up in the cold open because we know what's going to fucking happen,
of
right?
Course.
Because she also, in saying that statement, hang up and dial *69, is one of those statements when you watch a movie, you go, thank you. Thank you for being the only smart person in this fucking movie.
Right.
Yeah. Which, unfortunately, because she is a black woman and in the cold open, you know what's going to happen.
Yep.
So she goes out to get popcorn. Omar comes out, scares her. He goes to the restroom and gets stabbed through a toilet partition.
So
in the head. You can't do it, guys. I'm an interior designer. I've had to specify
right.
resin partitions. You ain't fucking stabbing through shit.
That's exactly what I thought of. And first of all, because he goes in, the urinals are taken. So he goes to one of the stalls.
Yeah.
Because one of the other stalls taken. Why does he put his head against the wall? Was there a noise that I didn't hear?
Same. That was my question. I was like, oh. And so I was kind of like watching it and I was like, it would be one thing if you heard like people making out and
yeah,
he'd
like
be
a
like,
girl
oh.
groaning or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And
or
I
like if somebody's knocking against the partition or something like that. But yeah, he seems intrigued.
He just decides to want to listen to this guy take a shit.
Yeah. I'm like, Omar, that's on you.
Yeah, that was not intelligent.
Yeah. Ghostface, he gave you what you were asking for.
Yeah.
Which is a knife in the head
yeah.
through a toilet partition.
That's also, exactly what I thought of, too. I'm like, there's no way that knife made it through there.
No way it made it through.
Head.
And also no way he got it back out of that. So
and
like,
also, there's no way that Ghostface would know that his face was up against it or where on that wall the face was.
I know. I was like, boy, he sure seems psychic.
Right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. It gets the job done.
It's, you know, a fun death to kick it off with.
Right.
Jada goes back into the theater. Omar in disguise. So
because he's wearing the ghost face,
ghost
but he's
face
also got Omar's clothes
is in his ghost
on.
Face mask, wearing Omar's clothes, comes back in, sits next to her. She ends up grabbing onto him during a scary scene, comes back up with her hands, and it's bloody. He stabs her right in the belly.
Yeah, he stabs her a number of times all
over. A number
over.
Of times. So this is where she gets stabbed in the belly, but because of all the pandemonium in the theater, nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
Also, he's dressed the same as everybody else, and everybody else has knives and also making stabbing motions.
Yes.
It's the perfect crime.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
this
the perfect
is one
public
time.
Crime.
If this had actually happened, yeah, he could have easily gotten away with
totally.
It.
Totally. And so there are a couple of grueling scenes where she tries to get away. He stabs her again, tries to get away. He picks her up or he stabs her again. Like it's, and nobody's noticing. Nobody's noticing because
right.
there's screaming and yelling and excitement and whatever in the theater.
Because at the same time as she's getting stabbed, Heather Graham is getting stabbed in the movie.
Exactly. So, like I said, I thought this was great filmmaking. I love this scene. I thought mm-hmm. it was meta. I thought it was a wonderful way to kick us off because we knew exactly what this movie was going to give us, was everything that we expected in sometimes a clever way, sometimes not a clever way, but you know what you're going to fucking get, right? They're going to have
right.
commentary not only on horror movies as a genre, but on the first movie. Until she walks up onto the stage.
Right.
I was like, Jada, girl.
Yeah.
You've been stabbed a lot.
First of all, I mean, it could have been, it looked like an older theater. So I guess there would still be a stage to walk onto. In a modern movie theater, there's nowhere to step onto because they're just projecting onto a flat wall.
Right. She would just be down at the bottom.
Yeah. This was obviously a converted theater.
But she,
into a movie theater.
She dies very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. She dies. Everybody slowly realizes that, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And then, bam, title card.
Yep.
Great cold open.
Which is, again, what they should have done in the first movie.
I know.
But they correct that mistake in this one.
They learn their lesson. So this whole podcast is a spoiler alert. We all know that. We won't reveal the killers until we start talking about that further on down the line. But in the first movie, there was a connection between Drew Barrymore and Matthew Lillard. They used
yes.
to date. So when they kick off their killing spree, didn't really make sense that they killed her. But if he was like, we're already going to kill a bunch of people anyway, and that bitch broke up with me.
Yeah.
Not giving him a justified reason to, but in his crazy mind, I could see why that happens.
Right.
In this, how do they know Omar and Jada?
They never say. And they go to the same school. The connection that they raise between the first three victims is so paper thin.
It's ridiculous.
There's no way that it could have ever worked.
No.
And they drop it as soon as they mention it, by the way.
Yeah.
Essentially, what Omar and Jada and then the third girl, which we'll get to when we get there, their names have commonalities with three of the victims from the first movie.
Right.
It's
super
like,
flimsy.
Whatever, Stevens. Well, the first person, you know, Steven was the one thing. And then right. I think it was Karen.
It was like Cece.
But her real name
whatever, but her
was
name was Casey something.
Casey,
yeah.
That's it.
And it's like.
And then Maureen was another name. And that just
and
happened
to align
with. And
that's the name of Sydney's mom.
Yes.
In the first movie. Yeah. And they weren't even like first name. It was like first name, last name. It like it just like very tenuous connection.
Yeah. Well, it's like. The killers knew these people's names. That's about the only connection
right.
that you can come up with.
And they went to the same school, Windsor College.
I mean,
it looks to be a big college, you know, like it was just very.
Did they actually say they go to the college?
News broadcast, they were like two Windsor students.
Ah, thank you.
You know, die in the theater or whatever. So that was the thing that I was kind of like, I mean, I loved it. I thought it was great. Hate that Jada and Omar had to go out that way because they are awesome together.
Yep.
And really could have used that personality in the movie. But whatever, they killed him off. That sucked. But yeah, I was like, there was no connection from the killers to them. And that's a bit of a bummer. Smash cut to the title card. And then we go right into Neve Campbell being super cute with her short hair, phone calls. I remember this scene. This is like the only scene I remember because I thought it was funny, which is she gets a phone call in her dorm room and it's hello, Sydney, you know, the stupid voice. And she's like, who is this? And I'm like, really, girl, why are you going to ask that every time? And he says something. It's like, do you like scary movies or do you know who I am or something like that? And she picks up the caller ID from 1997,
which is a separate unit attached to her phone.
Yep. And it's from she goes, Corey Gillis at 555-1234 or whatever the fuck it is. I thought it was cute. Whatever. Also like to point out the fact that her dorm room is massive, probably the size of my current apartment.
Yeah. Is it actually a dorm room or is it an apartment?
I don't know. That building looked like a school building to me. I mean, it was implausibly gigantic because she's in her dorm room.
It actually had multiple rooms. Yeah. My dorm room back in college was one room. And two beds.
Truthfully, the size of this storage room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two beds.
Dorm room movie boom.
Yeah. There you go. So anyway, she's in this giant dorm. We get to meet her roommate, who is Elise Neal, who's an actress you'd recognize from a couple of things in the 90s. Again, underserved. Black woman.
She's black.
Yeah. She's a black woman that has no personality whatsoever. They mentioned that she's like a psych major, but she has zero personality. All she cares about is Sydney.
And joining the sorority.
And joining a sorority of fucking weirdos.
Yeah.
I was like, this is so weird.
The whole subplot is just a total mess.
I think that I'm sure they attempted in this one to make commentary on the fact that anyone of color in a horror movie typically goes out very quickly.
Right.
But also that they're like at the time, a lot of mainstream horror movies did not have people of color in it.
Right.
So I think they were like, well, let's make commentary and then also diversify this movie. But they didn't totally make commentary on it. And they didn't also try to rectify that thing.
It's very much, and I'm going to go off on a little diatribe here, but do you remember, of course, you remember the show Daria?
Yeah.
You know, the animated Beavis and Butthead spinoff?
Sure do.
They had the character Jody, who was the black girl, for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. And they had several episodes spotlighting her, but every time they spotlighted her, it was always about race. It was never something about her character.
Right.
They were just trying to use her to talk about race, but they didn't actually use her. Well,
she wasn't a developed character. They
it
were
was
like,
just lip service.
Yes, totally.
And it really like once you kind of marathon that series, you really notice that she's not a character.
Yeah.
She is just a, you know, sounding board.
Well, yeah. And they also want to be patted on the back for being like, see, we have a black character and we reference things.
And that's exactly what they did with this movie, too.
I agree.
They gave it lip service, but they didn't try and change it.
Totally. Like if they had. After the cold open with Omar and Jada, then made reference to the fact in a more, I guess, objective way about how, like, because Dwayne Martin, who plays Joel, who, again, the weird camera guy that gets a bigger character, smaller character, whatever. It's a weird sort of thing, right? That is very clear. There are a lot of rewrites. Like, he makes reference to, you know, in scary movies, like, I'm not going to last long.
Yeah.
Like, it's one line. But honestly, if it had come from, like, Jamie Kennedy, then making commentary on the fact that Omar and Jada, a black couple, were killed in a scary movie situation, it would have had more intention to it. Like, it would have been them trying to rectify it, but they didn't. They did was give her poor roommate a horrible character to play that has zero personality whatsoever.
Yeah. And it would have, I mean, if the line had come from Jamie Kennedy, it would have, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this.
Would have had more authority?
Maybe, like, cause you have one of the main characters.
Right.
Cause right now it just shows the movie guy being somewhat ignorant of that aspect of filmmaking.
Sure.
Whereas it would have shown a lot more awareness by him and, you know, kind of the audience that he represents of understanding that that is a trope and, you know, you want to subvert or what have you.
Absolutely. Because he's the expert.
Yeah. Because he seems very ignorant of that. Like, they don't really give it any credence when the black camera guy says, hey, black guys usually die first, and nobody, they're like, whatever, go away, guy.
Yeah, and it's not even really played for a joke. Like, they didn't.
It's just matter of factly stated.
Yeah, they didn't make it a comedy moment. Yeah, they were like, oh, I guess we'll throw that in.
Right.
Yeah. So that was disappointing. I feel like, even though I will say on the whole, I did enjoy this movie. I mean, I wouldn't say that I liked it as much as the first one, certainly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there were some things like that where it's like you're making commentary, especially with the end on, you know, the horror movie genre. Here you have a subject, diversity in horror movies, right in fucking front of you. And you're like, kind of the thought was there to be like, should we address this? And then they don't.
Yeah.
So
it's all text and it's not subtext.
Exactly. Like, you're absolutely right. If Jamie Kennedy, because he has a great scene in this where they start to dissect who's a suspect, you're a suspect, I'm a suspect, and this person. And then he goes down the line. That's a great conversation he has with Dewey after they watch the movie or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would have been the perfect time to make reference, because he also goes through the rules again, the rules of the sequel. Like, just have more self-awareness of the genre as a whole. You're supposed to be an expert, Jamie Kennedy.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's get to Jamie Kennedy, because our next scene is a film class with Buffy, baby.
Yep, Buffy shows up.
Pacey
shows
baby
up.
Timothy Oliphant, baby. Yep.
Yeah,
wow.
There's so much 90s going on in this room
right now. Literal murderer's row of 90s fucking stars in this one tiny classroom.
Yep.
I loved it.
Yeah, it is. Oh, boy.
I knew Buffy was in it. Buffy was also in it was either this year or the following year. I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah.
Pacey, Joshua Jackson, was also in a teen horror movie called Urban Legend.
Yep.
And Timothy Oliphant is Timothy Oliphant. So here we go. And they're in the classroom with Jamie Kennedy. They're talking about sequels, obviously setting up, you know, the meta commentary of this movie being a sequel. And then Jamie Kennedy goes outside because he meets up with Sydney, who he's got a real fucking boner for still.
Yeah, it's been 2 years, dude. If she ain't going for you, then.
Yeah, he's got a real, so an interesting vibe here. I wrote down, I'm like, he somehow got hotter in a weird way.
He got a lot more buff, not like buff, but he's a lot more in shape.
He's a lot more in shape and also looks like he's like 8 inches taller. I was like, they shot these movies like back to back. I'm like,
he must have done, you know, he must work out.
He must have done something, because he definitely like is definitely more masculine and attractive in a general sense in this. But he's also just as fucking creepy about Sydney, if not more so, you know? Would you like to hear me say baby one more time? Because here comes the fat kid from Stand By Me, Jerry O'Connell.
Do it.
Baby. So he shows up being super preppy, real cute.
Yeah, he is the boyfriend.
We're on the quad now. A lot happens in the quad. This is the beginning in the movie, guys. So we've got the cold open. We've met Sydney. We've seen one of our surviving characters from the first one. We've met the boyfriend, which we know is going to be
a big deal.
A big deal. Now we're on the quad. And on the quad is where literally every other character has an interaction with every other character. It is a series of run-ins on this quad. So Courtney Cox, she's back, bitch.
With
bad hair.
Yeah.
It is crazy and noticeable. And that is the thing that I
They did at least make comment on it. It's not like they wanted you to take it at face value.
Oh, totally. And I remember that watching this because that wasn't even really, I mean, chunky highlights were a style in the 90s.
Right.
Thank God those did not come back.
Just give it time.
Knock on wood. Ugh, gross. But even then watching that, it was like, obviously she's an older, cheesy tabloid reporter who is trying to appear youthful. So she looks she's
also kind of going Hollywood because they're at this press conference the police are having on this quad. Mm-hmm. And whenever she is talking, she is snapping at her cameraman to put the camera on her.
She's so fucking good in this.
Yeah.
Dude, she is. I really, once again, as I mentioned last week, not a super huge fan of the show Friends.
Right.
But like, and maybe it's because she's allowed to be a different character in this. Mm-hmm. Courtney Cox is fucking good.
Yeah, she is. She's good.
Really good in this and so enticing and interesting. And like, you dislike her, but then you kind of like her. And then she's still kind of a bitch, even though you like her. And like, she's doing a great job.
Yeah, she vacillates in terms of, you know, where you should feel or how you should feel about her.
Absolutely.
Because like you said, she comes into this movie kind of being where she was character-wise at the beginning of the last movie. You know, I'm hot shit reporter. I've had this book that's being made into a movie. It's going to do great for your box office if these people got murdered, which hits a whole lot differently after that Dark Knight Rises shooting 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And then she kind of softens up later in the movie during interactions. And so you're like more sympathetic.
Yeah.
And then, she kind of goes through the same character arc again.
Yeah.
In terms of how she interacts with everyone else.
Right.
But she makes it work.
But you're right. I think softens is the accurate word, because you're right. In the first one, there's, she does have more of an arc. And in this one, she kind of takes the same arc, but she does end up at a different point where she is a more soft character, more caring. She's broken down those walls a little bit. I wrote down in my notes that the color of her hair is what I like to call Dragon Con red. Everybody knows that color hair. Also, here we are on the quad. They're doing the press conference. And who do we meet? Laurie Metcalf, baby. Another fucking cameo. It's just when I was watching this last night, I was like, I just can't believe it.
Yeah, they were going full 90s here. Now, I've known she's obviously done a number of big name things after the 90s, but I always I always think of Roseanne.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that was a landmark character for her.
Yeah,
absolutely. But she has gone on to fucking win awards. I mean, she's an extremely talented actress.
Yes.
And it was just great to fucking see her. I was like, look at that. And then I also wrote down Oliphant is a real skeeve, because he's got the same vibe as our Skeeve Ulrich,
he's kind of a mix between Skeeve Ulrich and Jamie Kennedy, to where I basically refer to him throughout my notes as not Jamie Kennedy.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's also into film, right? He's in the film class with him. He's got a camera, you know, like.
They have a bit of a running gag in terms of him trying to name a sequel that is better than the original.
Correct.
With Jamie Kennedy, and it goes through several scenes.
Absolutely. as we mentioned before, Elise Neal, who plays the unfortunate roommate of Sydney, is all about getting in this stupid sorority. And I'm like, whatever. And in walks up Noxzema girl, baby, and Portia de Rossi.
Nope. I knew Portia de Rossi. I didn't know the other girl was Noxzema girl, seen her.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's probably where it got tucked away in my subconscious.
Noxzema girl, who has a real name that I didn't bother to look up, was married for a very long time to, it was either McSteamy or McDreamy, one of those guys. Anyway, Portia de Rossi has some insane eyebrows in this movie.
She's always had insane eyebrows.
Yeah, but like after this, when she gets to Ally McBeal, they thin up and get really super 90s thin and arched, almost like pencil thin drawn on. In this,
they're thick.
They are.
And dark.
But they're also perfectly round. She has an interesting shape of her eyebrows. She's just a real fucking goofball in this. She's a side character. She's no one of note. She just shows up as a face.
Yeah. For being basically nobody to the plot, she gets a lot of FaceTime.
She does get a lot of FaceTime. But I think that's why it's so strange. It's like we get all these cameos and like perhaps that's them.
A lot of this is fluff. You could cut out a good amount of this movie just based on characters that show up a lot that don't do anything.
Yeah, because she and Noxzema girl proved to be utterly pointless.
They're not even intimated to possibly be suspects.
No,
they
not
are just
at all.
There.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not even red herrings.
Totally. So this all happens on the quad. Another interaction that happens on the quad is Dewey shows up. He's still alive. He's heard that there were murders and he comes to check in on Sydney. They go and stand in a gazebo together. And I thought they were going to make out. It was weird and
flirtatious.
There's
a lot of close talking going on.
There's so much close talking. And like, yeah, I know that they have like a brother-sister relationship because her best friend and his sister was fucking murdered by a garage door in the last movie. But they look like they're going to make out at some point. And I was weirded out by it, truthfully.
I didn't read it that way, but I could see how. I mean, just because like I said earlier, he doesn't look physically compatible with any human. So I imagine he's just going to start making out with somebody.
I think it's more her. She's like obviously happy to see him, but there's something about, you know, kind of that Neve Campbell way of acting, and she's like happy and looking down, which makes her seem bashful, which makes her seem kind of flirtatious. Like it was a strange combination. Okay. So maybe I'm the only one that picked up on it. But also now we once again meet from the first movie, Liev Schreiber.
Yes, he has more of a role here. He's doing a very good job.
He's doing a great job being a fucking bitch in this movie.
Yeah, basically. He's trying to be a publicity hound since he got exonerated mm-hmm. for the murder of Sydney's right. mom. Mm-hmm. And he's basically trying to go out on the publicity circuit to pretty much get his story out there, get his, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Reputation redeemed.
Yes, exactly.
You know, he's trying to go on a rehab.
And to make a buck at it.
Exactly.
You know? It also says they mentioned at some point, they're like, she put you in jail for a year. I'm like, a fucking year? Like, yeah. I'm not saying I would want to spend a year in jail, but like, come on.
Yeah, I could understand if it was like five.
Yeah.
Three.
A decade of your life.
A decade.
One year. Fucking get over it.
I mean, people have been on benders for more than a year.
Yeah, exactly. So Cordy and Cotton, once again, the worst character name of all time. They tried to surprise Sydney with an interview, and then she punches Courtney Cox again in the face.
Yeah, can we get a counter in this series of the number of times that Courtney Cox gets punched in the face or beaten up? Because it seems to be a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. Let's add
all right,
a ding.
It's a recurring theme.
Right here.
All right.
So we're introduced to Joel, who is Dwayne Martin. Dwayne Martin, the actor, I think shortly after this, was married to Tisha Campbell. Tisha Campbell, you may know as Gina from Martin.
Damn, Gina.
Right?
I had a feeling that I've seen him before, too, yes. in other things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He looks very familiar.
Exactly. Another 90s guy, you know?
Yeah.
So he's in there. And as we mentioned before, I'm guessing during the rewrites that, like, they had to make up for the fact that, like, they had to change some people from being the killer to not being the killer. And so they had some filler because at one point he fucking leaves. He gets in a cab and leaves.
Yeah. So I don't know if we want to talk about this now, but I want to mention it. I think he should have been one of the killers.
What connection would he have had?
I'm trying to think, at least from a metatextual standpoint, I don't know. Because the two killers that they do have in this movie are so tenuously connected, if at all.
Oh, for sure.
You could have easily transplanted one of them, and we'll get there,
of them makes sense. The other one does not.
What? Yeah. I just think, you know what? Let's put a pin in this. I just think he should have been one of them, but we'll put a pin in it when we get to the reveals.
When we get to the reveal.
I'll give a bit more reasoning behind
my thought
process.
Top five people who should have been the killers that weren't the killers.
Yeah, a list that we will never come back to.
There you go. Courtney Cox runs into Dewey. They have a little fight again on the quad. This is like the tail end of our long-ass quad scene where we've got to reintroduce all of our millions of characters. They have a fight because she writes about him in her book, and he goes, nice streaks. In reference to her hair. And I was like, good one, Dewey.
Yeah, that's a very Dewey insult right there.
I liked it.
Of course, if because they don't explicitly say what the book is, I'm assuming it's a novelization of the events.
She kind of makes it sound
that way. Because she embellishes different things. Like, she says that her cameraman got gutted when he actually just got his throat cut.
Exactly. Yeah, she makes reference. She's like, it's just a book. Like, it, you know.
And the fact that they made a movie, that type of movie off of it, made me think novelization.
Exactly.
Based on the real events. Whereas if she was smart, she would have made it a true crime book and then made a podcast.
I know. Back
granted,
in the day.
This was the pre-podcast era. But
it would have just been a radio show.
You could have just written a true crime book. And then when podcasts came along in 2003, 2004, whatever, mm-hmm. you could have just like done it again and boom.
Yeah.
You could have run away with that.
Lessons learned, Courtney.
I know. You didn't understand the technology or didn't understand where it could go and it cost you.
Abso-fucking-lutely. So they go to a stupid sorority party. The only thing I'd like to mention is that poor Elise Neal's hair is very 90s and very stupid, where she's got the big curls that aren't combed out. It was very like 90s at the time, if you remember that. Also, Our Tweedledee and Tweedledum of this are Noxzema Girl and Portia de Rossi, because they show up, they're always together, and they're always doing something stupid. Like, for example, drinking martinis at a college party.
Right.
Go, whatever. Guys.
That would have been crap out of a red Solo cup.
Oh, 100%. Hunch punch. Yeah. Like, these bitches would have been falling over.
Yeah.
Speaking of falling over.
I also think they were gay.
Ooh, maybe.
There's nothing to their characters, but I'm going to say that they were gay.
See, that would have been nice.
It's not because Portia's gay in real life. Just the way that I read those two characters.
And I wish that they would have delved into that. They do make a reference to one guy being gay.
I also think there's a lot of homosexual undertones in Greek life overall.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. Well,
obviously, I did not do fraternity or obviously not sorority stuff. But yeah, I think that's kind of BS. But there's a lot of stuff you could read into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand the whole Greek life thing. It's not appealing to me.
I'm
going
to pay to have friends that abuse me.
Yeah. 100%.
And, you know,
do you know how much money, you know, I was told this by, like, I don't think it was a roommate in college, but like had to have been a friend of a friend. I don't think I had any friends that were in sororities, but it was like, not only do you have like dues and things like that, and you have to pay for like events and all this shit. And you have to, obviously if you live in the house, you get to pay and all this stuff. If you miss a meeting, you have to pay.
Ugh.
It's like nickel and diming you left and right.
It's like a scam,
right?
Such a scam.
Fucking weird thing. All right, guys, let us know that we're correct. So let's move on.
Patreon episode about the BS
about the Greek
life in the movies. There we go.
Ooh, Greek life in the movies. Bing. That's a good Patreon episode.
That we will never make.
Oh, you would have to watch Animal House in order to do that.
That is true. I have never seen Animal House.
That could be a good Patreon episode, actually, because that is problematic.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, a Greek life college episode made in the 70s. I'm sure there's nothing at all that's objectionable nowadays.
Wow. It is it's quite terrible. Anyway, so hard cut to the sorority house where all of the girls have left and gone to this party that we had just visited. And Miss Buffy Summers is there alone.
Yeah, she's waiting for me to call. I was really busy.
She's looking so cute in that little pink sweater.
And those like over waist high pants.
It was the 90s.
I know.
Like they weren't called mom jeans. They were just called jeans. Yeah. Like,
I mean, they go up to her belly button.
Practically.
Yeah.
It's like overalls that they forgot to put a bib on it. Again, she gets a call from Ghostface, does the thing. She thinks it's her boyfriend and he's drunk and they have a little bit of conversation, hears something upstairs. And then another dumb sorority girl pops in and does some bad acting where she's like really close to Buffy's face.
Right.
Yeah. So Sarah Michelle Gellar is acting in this, doing a great job being Buffy. And this other girl is just like leering at her face the whole time. I was like, did someone direct her? Like, please, like, help this poor woman
she
out.
She must have been like a niece of one of the guys on set. And they're like, could you just give her something to do?
Exactly. Or at least this is her first gig. But she's only there briefly.
The funny thing here is that they're talking on the phone or they're talking by the phone away from the front door, which Sarah Michelle Gellar has left open. So we see the two girls in kind of the right side of the frame and the door's on the left. And then you see Ghostface just kind of jump in the doorway, look cartoonishly at the camera and zip off to the right.
Hilarious.
It was the goofiest thing.
Super goofy.
It's like you knew the guy was going to get in the house somehow, but that's how he does it.
I know.
He just Scooby-Doos his way through the door.
Doop, 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 doop. they maintained a lot of the slapsticky nature of whomever is wearing the Ghostface costume.
Yes and no. They don't keep it up.
This part is very slapsticky and funny.
Yeah.
It's a stupid thing where actually it's not stupid. It was very 90s, which is her friend goes, okay, I'm going to the party. Bye. And she's like, don't forget to set the alarm. She sets the alarm. Ghostface calls her again, says something, and she thinks he's outside. And then her like friend calls. I forget the order of operations. Anyway, she's on the phone with another girl and the girl goes, call the campus police.
So that was before
she opened the door
and went outside to check.
Either way, she goes outside and she starts losing connection on the cordless phone. This is kids.
This was a real problem.
Real problem. You get too far from the cradle. That bitch don't work.
Yeah, it's a staticky mess.
Sure is. And everybody had that same phone with the antenna that's the size of one of those pencils for like...
Yeah, like about as long as your thumb.
Yeah, exactly. And with the same diameter as well.
Exactly.
It's the most ridiculous cordless phone you've ever seen. And so she has to creep back into the house because she can't get service while standing on the patio.
Right.
Which I was like, run away.
Yeah.
Run away.
Yeah. it's okay to leave the house abandoned. I mean, what do you guys have in there that's really valuable?
First dumb move, students. She doesn't just run away.
Right.
Also, as soon as her friend leaves, because she pops up, does a little jump scare.
Technically, girly, like the order of operations was she's on the couch, gets the call. The girl on the phone says to call the police. She goes outside to try and do that. It doesn't work. She comes back in. Other girly pops in. They have conversation by the phone.
Yes.
Ghostface guy bumbles in through the front door.
Yep.
And then other girl leaves.
And right after other girl leaves is when...
Doesn't Ghostface tell her to turn on the alarm?
Yes. Ghostface immediately references that he is in the fucking house or that he knows what's up. Do you know what you could have done? Open that door and run the 10 feet that your friend walked away.
Yeah.
Grabbed her and run away.
Yeah.
Or yelled at her.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Buffy, what are you fucking doing?
Well, she's clearly not Buffy because otherwise she would have beat the shit out of this guy.
Absolutely. So she wanders around kind of briefly. There's a very clear shot where, once again, she picks up my other favorite telephone, which is the clear case phone where you can see all of the cabling and.
Yep.
Classic. It made me so happy to see that. One of my favorite parts of the whole movie was that telephone. And behind her, you can obviously see a door that's ajar under the stairs. Ghostface pops out and she throws a plant at him. Comical.
Yes. Very
and then
much.
She runs upstairs immediately because she's a dumb girl, right? She's a dumb girl in a horror movie. So she runs up the stairs and she throws a plant at him and then she rolls a bicycle at him down the stairs.
Not even halfway.
It's hilarious.
Not even a thick bike. It's just so funny.
So not only does she go up one flight of stairs, she goes up another flight of stairs to another floor.
Yeah.
And he catches up to her, throws her through a window.
Yep.
Steps out, stabs her twice.
And then throws her off the building. If you're going to throw off the building, just do that.
He likes to fucking stab people, man.
I guess, but...
Gotta use that blade. Stabs her, throws her off the building.
Yeah.
And Buffy is gone. I would like to say, as a personal note, I remember when this movie came out, obviously being a Buffy fan at the time, still being a Buffy fan, of her, not of Joss Whedon anymore, I guess. But I remember in interviews, Sarah Michelle Gellar said, because she plays such a skilled, active fighter in Buffy, it was hard for her to kind of act like a dumb girl that's bumbling and whatever in this movie. So she said that she put rocks in her shoes to help her be more clumsy and less agile.
Oh, well, that's clever.
So I remember that from 1997. I don't know if it's true or not, but anyway.
It's a good story.
So she did. Back at the other house, there's a joke about blowjobs and doing it harmonica style. And I wrote down corn on the cob.
Okay. All right then.
So it just made me laugh. Jamie Kennedy pops up. There's a quick little, where were you, Jamie Kennedy? So we're casting a bit of suspicion briefly onto Jamie Kennedy.
Briefly. This movie does. Yeah, it's very clumsy in terms of trying to get you to think or not think that different people are the suspect.
And like,
it doesn't seem to give you any solid clues. You're just supposed to suspect everybody.
Yeah, basically. Timothy Olyphant is there. He like says something to Elise Neal, the roommate. It's a very kind of a brief scene. Boyfriend, the fat kid from Stand By Me, comes in, talks to Sydney very briefly. And then everybody goes, oh, my God, something happened at the sorority house. And so mass exodus.
Right.
Another scene that I laughed at a lot was how fast and comically these cop cars fly up to the sorority house. Here's a question. Can cop cars be slapstick? Because
did you see Blues Brothers?
Well, there you go. That's what I was thinking of the whole time. I was like, this is hilarious. This is some excellent acting by these cop cars. I mean, really, it's the same sort of ridiculous sort of nature as Ghostface. Those cop cars could have been the killer in this.
Yeah.
Oh, number one. Should have been the killer.
Should have been the cop cars.
So they go back to the house. They're like, oh, Buffy Summers was thrown off the roof. It was definitely not a suicide. Laurie Metcalf is there.
Because she was stabbed twice.
Yeah, exactly. So that's probably why at least the movie was like, we have to show that she was, you know, quite clearly killed and not suicidal.
True.
Laurie Metcalf is there. She runs into Courtney Cox. You've got to see that Laurie Metcalf is there. Joel, the camera operator, is like, yo, I just came here to do an interview with Cotton. I'm not here to do all this shit. Like, this is not what I signed up for.
Right.
And he mentions Faces of Death. And I was like, ugh. Anyway, guys, don't watch don't watch VHS copies of Faces of Death. I've never seen it, but I think it's disgusting that it even exists. So,
I'm unfamiliar with that one.
But. Oh, it's like a series of gross videos of people dying, and some of them are fake and some of them are real. It's disgusting.
Oh, it's like the Cannibal Holocaust type stuff.
I don't know what that is.
That is a, well, it was the name of a movie, and it was about cannibals, but they like have scenes where they're killing animals, but they are actually killing animals on camera.
Yeah.
And you don't want to see that.
Yeah, exactly. Guys, don't watch terrible stuff like this. Watch terrible stuff like Scream 2.
Yeah. Watch terrible fake stuff, not terrible stuff where they actually harm living creatures.
So because everybody has vacated the first party, Sydney is like, let's get out of here. She's standing on the front porch with Jerry O'Connell. He goes, grab your jacket and let's go. And I go, why is everybody so concerned for her? Everybody is concerned for Sydney in this movie and yet leaving her alone constantly.
Yeah.
Very frustrating. She goes back in and gets her suede purple jacket.
Oh, yeah.
Classic. Classic night.
Classic.
And the phone starts to ring as she leaves. She just can't stand it. She's got to answer that phone.
I know.
She just calls.
Literally.
Because here's the thing, guys. If you don't answer the phone, Ghostface might still pop out, but he might not. He likes talking on the phone.
Yeah.
He's a child of the 80s and 90s, not unlike ourselves. I love talking on the phone. So she picks up the phone. It's Ghostface. He runs in. They start fighting. Somehow she can't get the front door open after it's been slammed shut. So she and Jerry O'Connell.
That was locked.
But she's on the lock side of the fucking door.
For all you know, it could be one of those weird locks where you like need the key from both sides because they installed it wrong. I don't know. Maybe they showed it off.
I think you are giving this movie too much credit, Samwise.
Well, that's possible.
So either way, she and Fatkin from Sam Raimi are separated by this door. She's running through the house, attempting to evade Ghostface. There are bars on the window at the sorority house for some reason.
Maybe security. Maybe it's a rough neighborhood.
I guess it is.
They meet around back. And Jerry meet around back, which it was just open the whole time. Okay.
Well, it actually was when everybody exited the party, so I believe that.
All right, fair enough. So then Chubby goes right back in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scuffle. Dewey shows up.
Yep.
Dewey finds that, boyfriend has been cut on the arm.
Yes.
Nothing major, but it's still bleeding.
And it's suspicious, right? Because not only do we have Jerry O'Connell going in by himself and he just has a flesh wound, a mere flesh wound, but also Dewey shows up and you're like, oh, okay. Well, then how did Dewey get here?
Yeah,
and
it also makes you think of the end of the first movie where they were stabbing each other to try and create false positives, essentially.
Yeah, and there's a quick scene in a lavender hospital after this they tried to cast suspicion onto Jerry O'Connell because of that, because he's pre-med and he didn't slice into any tendons or arteries or anything like that. Whatever. This is the quick scene where they go to the cop station and they do the name bullshit.
Yeah, the name stuff that we'd already mentioned. So we'll skip over it.
We'll skip over that. In light of all of this shit, there are two cops from the 1970s that have now been tasked with following Sydney around.
Yeah, these guys are terrible at their job.
Abso-fucking-lutely. So she has a quick little scene where she tries to break up with Jerry O'Connell because she's like, you need to stay away from me. A, because obviously she's like a little suspicious of him being the boyfriend.
Yeah.
And also because his flesh wound was merely a flesh wound. And then they go to the cafeteria and I hate this fucking scene a lot.
First of all, there's a lot of white people in this cafeteria.
Yeah.
There's like one black person and it's the girl
and
that's
with you.
He gives
them a high five. Did you see that?
No, I missed that part.
The movie, this movie. So what happens is
Jerry Connell sings a musical number to try and make it up to his girlfriend. The funny thing I think about this is they're sitting at the table, everyone but Neve Campbell.
Yeah.
She walks up towards the camera. Jerry pulls out a chair for her, which is apparently directly in front of the camera. It's kind of hard. If you're not looking for it, it's not easy to see.
It's kind of weird.
So that, she'll sit, next to me. She sits down on the opposite side of the table and he kind of gets this, feeling and pushes the chair back in and you kind of feel bad for him for a minute. I'm so sad.
She just tried to break up with you. What did you think was going to happen?
I know, right? Come on.
So somehow he takes this and, I wrote this down. It's a TikTok moment, 20 years in the making, where he jumps up on a table in a crowded cafeteria full of white people.
Yeah.
And begins to sing. And
Poorly.
Timothy Oliphant makes reference to a Tom Cruise movie because he's the other movie guy, right?
Yeah. He's not Jamie Kennedy.
And You know, so then somehow it's charming. The thing that I think is weird about this scene is that people just start clapping, but not singing along. Most scenes, people would have been singing along with this notable song.
Right. But even then, I didn't know all the words.
It's I Think I Love You, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, I don't know all the words to it.
I mean, like, I know the chorus and that's about it.
Right. But he like sings multiple multiple verses and the chorus several times. Like, he goes for it.
He goes for it. And supposedly it's charming. He gets down. The only black guy gives him a high five. And I'm like, God damn it. What the fucking fuck? We've already killed Jada Pinkett Smith. How dare you?
I know.
And so Fat Kid from Stand By Me gives Sydney his Greek letters.
Which, like,
I hate this. I hate this so much.
Yeah, this is so stupid.
It's really stupid. I was really hoping, because he says even the line of something like, it will protect you. And I was like, ooh, maybe she'll get shot and we'll realize that this tiny little necklace
deflected the bullet just enough to where it didn't, you know.
That's what happens, right?
No.
Anytime you're given a gift, you're given a book or a badge or a something, and a guy puts it in his pocket or you put something around your neck. Hello.
Yeah, MacGuffin. It's going to come back. Oh, yeah. Chekhov's gun is definitely going to fire on that.
For sure. So this is a stupid scene, and it's like he's proposing to her, but with this stupid necklace, and I did not like it.
Nope. Hate it.
There are other things in this movie that I like. I did not like this. Now we're at the scene that I was referencing earlier, where we're seeing a bit of footage from a TV show, and we see Nancy O'Dell, who is an actual trash movie reporter.
Right.
Or trash TV reporter. She's talking with Tori Spelling, who's playing that. And then Dewey and Jamie Kennedy are having the conversation about, like, who's playing who? David Schwimmer's playing Dewey. So now we have all of the Friends references, because they referenced Jennifer Aniston earlier in the movie as well. And they show a scene from the movie where Tori Spelling,
the award winning Luke Wilson.
He's so awesome.
He's so ridiculous. I immediately flashed to Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man 3. I'm like, did he watch this 2-second bit of Luke Wilson and say, that's what I want for Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, because they give him the Skeet Ulrich hair that's hanging in the greasy curtains, and he has the exact conversation.
The exact same.
In the scene from the movie, the first movie, before Sydney goes into the bathroom at school.
Yes.
Where somehow Ghostface is in there, but it's about giving her shit about, your mom died like a year ago. Why can't we just fuck already? And so at the end of this, Tori Spelling runs off and then he slaps himself in the head and goes, dope. It's fucking like, great. I love Luke Wilson. That was great.
That was so ridiculous.
So this is where Jamie Kennedy, again, goes into what should have been our expert speech. He's dictating what happens. Who's a suspect? Why? Everybody's a suspect. Here's what it could be. Here's what it couldn't be. All these things. Also, these are the rules of the sequels, which are there's always a higher body count. It's always gorier. And a third thing that he gets cut off and doesn't finish.
About franchising, which I thought was the interesting part. Because is he saying in order to make a franchise or in order to kill a franchise, you have to blank?
I don't remember.
Either way, they cut off that part.
Yeah.
Obviously, knowing that this was going to be a franchise.
For sure.
So they didn't want to shoot themselves in the foot,
exactly.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, again, this would have been a great point for them to have the conversation about Omar and Jada being a black couple that's killed in the beginning.
Yep.
Would have been a great moment to have a conversation about race in horror movies.
Exactly.
They did not. And it was a fucking bummer.
Yeah. And this is basically the last time, until the end of the movie, ham-fistedly tries to throw it back in, where they really get meta with it. The majority of the second half of this movie is just a stereotypical slasher film. They get rid of all of the charm and the meta nature of it. It is taken purely at face value, and it really does it a disservice.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. So
Dev goes to the theater because she's apparently in theater and wants
theater
to quit.
Kid.
And I have to point out her acting coach.
Yes, David Warner.
I didn't know his name. He has done a number of different things, but of course he was on Star Trek: The Next Generation as the Cardassian general. I forget his name. He was great in that.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Batman, the animated series as Ra's al Ghul. He was great in that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in one of my three number one shows of all time, Gargoyles, as the Archmage.
Look at this fucking guy.
He is just wonderful. I love him and everything. He was also in Ninja Turtles 2.
he's in
Secret
everything.
Of the Ooze.
Yeah.
He was very busy around this time and he earns it because he is just wonderful.
And it was such a weird short scene. This is his only scene.
Yeah.
He's there. He's her acting coach or whatever. She wants to quit the play. they have a conversation where he basically convinces her not to, which I was like,
which is weird considering the context of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Which is a Greek play.
Agamemnon.
On, oh, that's the play. Okay.
I had to look it up. I didn't know. I mean, I knew Cassandra, the image in Cassandra.
And I knew the area. I just forgot that it was a play.
Correct. Yeah.
And also, am I the only one that kind of wants to see Neve Campbell star in a full on Greek tragedy like this? Because she actually did very well.
She did great. And she looked beautiful.
Yeah.
Also, like, I was like, hold on. If this is just a rehearsal, yo.
They went all out.
They went all out. And also, I guess if it was a dress rehearsal, but also like, I mean, her hair looked fucking great. Her makeup.
Yeah.
She had that red lipstick on. She looked fucking awesome.
And apparently that musical score was done by Danny Elfman, according to the credits. Yeah.
This movie.
For that scene.
See, for all the shit things that I don't like to say about it, there's a few things where I'm like, I enjoyed that.
Yeah. It planted the idea of Neve Campbell in Greek tragedy. And I just want to see that now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so there's a lot of really advanced production design for this theater department.
Yeah.
Yes. They have all sorts of things. They have like, you know, giant sets with operable parts with doors and stones and like columns and
lighting
and
effects,
And then the big metal sheet that's meant to represent thunder and lightning. Yep. And so there's a scene where she is Cassandra, says something, and then the Greek chorus behind her who all have masks on.
Yep.
And then Ghostface kind of gets in the mix in there. And so it's a fun scene where she's spinning around. They're chasing her. You see glimpses of Ghostface. That's it. She falls on the ground and they go, everybody take five. Jerry O'Connell comes backstage and goes, because again, he surreptitiously shows up because they want to point out like, hey, what are you doing here, Jerry O'Connell? We just saw Ghostface a moment ago. And this is when she like officially breaks up with him.
Yeah. So I think you could have cut out the faux breaking or the faux makeup scene with the musical number.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any need for that because it would have meant that there was more surprise that he showed up.
Yeah.
When he did.
Right.
Because she's surprised now. And he's like, oh, blah, blah, blah was doing something else. So I had to fill in for him.
Right.
Which I don't know. I think it would have been more effective if they hadn't made up two scenes prior. And it was just a total left field that he's even here.
Totally. The next scene is again on the quad. And this is a good scene. It's a good scene.
Courtney Cox is smoking. And I wrote, ew, women smoking. Sorry, that's just nasty. I mean, granted, anybody smoking, I think, is nasty. But maybe it's just because I'm a guy, but that is probably the least attractive thing a woman can
do. She also is holding a cigarette. Like, I don't think that she must be an actual smoker because she's holding it like it's the most foreign thing in the world. Like, she looks very unnatural.
She doesn't seem to know what to do with it when she's not smoking it.
Exactly. Because Dewey even goes, why is she smoking? Or something stupid like that. Anyway.
Which I'm wondering, again, was like an improv line because they realized how awkward she's doing this.
I know. So it's, we've got Courtney Cox. We've got Dewey. We've got Jamie Kennedy, our survivors from the first movie. And they're kind of sitting.
Plus the black guy.
Yeah. Joel is there. Not really doing much.
Yeah.
Because they don't give him a lot. It's not on him.
Right.
They fucking wrote him to be just a background player, which would be fine because the camera guy in the first one was also kind of a background player.
Right.
But like, if you're trying to make a comment, make a comment. This is where she mentions the thing about her head on Jennifer Aniston's body.
Yep.
I did like that she and Dewey call each other bonehead a couple of times, which is one of my favorite put downs.
That was such a weird, weird insult.
So Courtney Cox's phone rings. But she doesn't answer, so Jamie Kennedy picks it up. Great cell phone, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Great fucking cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
It's the size of an actual cordless phone, but the
bottom kind of flips out.
Yeah, the mouthpiece just flips down.
Yeah.
So it's Ghostface, and he basically says, I can see you right now.
Yeah, and so Dewey and Courtney are like, keep him on the phone. We're going to go find him.
Which, when they say that, I'm like, he can fucking see you.
Also, he can be inside.
Yeah.
He can be in a building looking at you, but they assume that he is on the quad holding a cell phone. So they go up and harass everyone who's on a cell phone.
So this dumb duo is running around attacking people that have cell phones.
Yeah.
Jamie Kennedy is kind of wandering around in the middle of space, you know, being a little funny. He does say fuck a couple of times, which is, I think, is when I noticed. I was like, oh, this movie says that a lot.
Yeah.
Because he goes, what's your favorite scary movie? And he says Showgirls.
Right.
Quippy. And so Jamie Kennedy is again wandering around in here. He's being really sassy. You think that he's safe because he's in the middle of nowhere and he wanders too close to the camera van.
But he doesn't at the same time. They make, I don't know if it's an editing error or what have you. So he does go very close. He goes right beside the news van.
Mm-hmm.
But then they show him walk away from the news van, totally across on the opposite side of the street.
20 feet away.
And that's when he starts shit talking Billy and Stu from the first movie.
Yep.
And then apparently the door opens up. Ghostface snatches him in the van. But there's no way that she could have just, or you know, Ghostface could have just snatched him like that because would have had to cross the road, drag him back across the road and into the van.
Exactly. So, yeah, they...
The geography is messed up.
Geography is messed up. Because it is surprising, because you see him get close to the van and you're like, don't do that. And then he walks away quite clearly, like 20 feet away.
Yeah, the movie shows you clearly that he has walked away.
So
there is a wide shot right before he gets grabbed that shows the van and him on the complete opposite side, a big wide shot. So there's no confusion about, oh, he must have been right next to the van. It's we kind of flubbed this up.
Yeah. And I think that this is part of the rewrites.
I don't think
he was supposed to die in this one. I think he was probably either supposed to be one of the killers or he was supposed to live because it just seemed a little weird.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, he gets killed into the van and killed big time.
And there's a question I have about this when it's revealed who kills him.
Yes. She's not strong enough to do it.
Exactly. Like, they show you, like, he goes in the van, and it's not like an immediate, the van shakes, and then a blood splash on the window. Like, it's not that quick, because they even show you in the rear view, him and Ghostface facing each other one-on-one.
Yeah.
And there is a clear struggle.
Right.
And then he is, thrown on the ground and stabbed.
Yeah. And you see the van shaking, and then you see Jamie Kennedy's body thrown against the window, because it shatters.
Yes. So... Should we just go ahead and say who this killer is?
We can go ahead and say who this is, but in reference to Jamie Kennedy again getting jacked for this movie.
Yeah.
Now it doesn't make sense, because what we know at this point, that it is Skeeve Ulrich's mom.
Laurie Metcalf. There is no way she overpowered this now buff Jamie Kennedy and stabbed him.
No.
There's no way. If it had been one thing, if it had actually been a snatch and stab to where he could not react.
Right.
They show us that he has reacted and is now counterattacking.
Totally.
There's no way that this goes down like this.
No way. Like, it would have been one thing. I wish it would have been, if they had to kill him and they had to kill him in this manner, keep him next to the van. He's still talking shit as he's turning to leave. He's still in front of the van, but his back is to it. Door slides open. She slits his throat.
Yeah. Because
that doesn't take any, I mean, obviously it takes physical power, but it's not like this fight that they're showing in the van.
Yeah.
He falls forward. Basically, it's the same effect, because Tweedledee and Tweedledum walk up and they see the blood dripping out of the van.
Yeah.
But as opposed to just seeing his body crumpled up at the foot of the van.
Right.
You know, also, she left the ghost face mask.
Yeah.
I mean,
this was 1997. You could do DNA.
That was my exact fucking thought. And I go, DNA, bitch, and hair. I mean, come on. What are you fucking doing?
Even at this point in time, they probably would have found enough in that mask.
Absolutely.
To do this.
So, I mean, it might have taken them a lot longer. Granted.
That's true. By the time that they had processed it, this whole thing would have played out, because it's over what? 3 or 4 days at most.
Tops. Like 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like 3 days, I think. Yes, anyway, we lose Jamie Kennedy, which is, I think, a bummer.
It's very much to the movie's detriment.
I think so, too. It was, I didn't enjoy that. I mean, it was like a surprise, and not in a cool surprise, like in a George R.R. Martin way, where you're like, what? Scene bean? You know, it's not like killing off one of your favorite characters, even though you do. It's that, you know, it's like, he's been such an integral part in being the horror movie expert.
He was very much woven into the DNA of this series.
Correct. And they stomped it out.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't think that would have happened in the original script.
Right.
I bet it wouldn't have.
So Sydney's at the library now using a ghetto ass computer operating system. Even for 1997, this crap looks 10 years out of date.
But you know what I will say in defense of that, because I noticed the same thing. When I was a freshman in college in the year 2000, so just a couple years after this.
In the year 2000.
I remember during orientation having to go in one of the computer labs, and tell me if you remember this, because you were a couple years after me, going and signing up for classes and then having to fill in all of this documentation on like an MS-DOS type program. It was like green font, go in, you put an X on the class that you want, and that's how you like chose your classes. Do you remember this?
I'm trying to remember.
I have a distinct memory because I was like...
They may have overhauled the system in the 2 years between us.
Perhaps.
But I also don't remember. So it's entirely possible.
I remember it because it already felt antiquated. I was like, this is the year 2000. We've passed Y2K, guys.
Yeah.
The fuck? We survived it. So, yeah. So that's the only reason why I'm like, even though this college campus looks amazing, all the buildings are beautiful, looks very... money filled.
Yes.
They still have computers the size of Buicks with the world's oldest software running on it.
Oh, yeah.
she gets an instant message.
If you want to call it that.
I mean, they call it that, which I'm like, less instant than you think.
Right. You have to put a manual command to read this message, which apparently changes the color scheme of your yep. monitor entirely until yeah. you open this message. Like, because it's a standard DOS blue, yep. which if you know DOS, you know this color. And she's typing and then it inverts and it's like yellow, just yeah. DOS yellow mm-hmm. with black icons.
Right.
And it's going to stay that way until she opens this message by pressing whatever two right. or three button combo she has to do this.
So funny.
Yeah, it's definitely not a graphic interface. Gosh,
it's a control O and then
control O.
So anyway, she gets this threatening message and she just stands up and goes, oh, shit, he's here. And the two dumb cops from 1978 grab her, stick her next to a doorway and go, stay right here.
And I'm they like, just
stop leaving her places, guys.
Yes.
Guys, stop leaving her alone.
And then Cotton shows up and begins to harass her for 5 minutes while the cops are just fucking around.
A lot of close face threatening.
Yeah.
They're on the stairs. He's like really into her face. Where is Liev Schreiber from?
When he, like nationality wise, yeah. I want to say he's Canadian, but I could be full of it.
His accent is so strange.
Let's find out, shall we?
And elevator music.
No. He was born. He's American.
Okay.
Born in California.
Really? Because he kind of sounds like I'm getting East Coast, like New England vibes, not like Boston, not like North New England, but more
maybe
like,
they just had him do that.
That's what I was wondering. I didn't know if he was putting on an accent, but like there's something about his voice that reminds me of like New Jersey, New York.
Yeah, maybe
subtlety
they just had
of it.
Him do
anyway,
that.
But he is threatening her, doing a great.
He really wants to get on Diane Sawyer.
Yeah,
and
he does.
Can't get on there and get paid unless she comes along,
which is so crazy. I'm like, they would have just accepted an interview with you.
Right.
They wouldn't have been like, nope, it's either you and Nev or nothing.
Exactly.
Like, come on. If they're trying to scoop this interview, really?
Yeah.
Come on. So anyway, he's like, yo, do this interview with me. Do it.
The whole scene is to make us think, oh, Cotton's actually crazy and he's probably doing this.
Exactly.
Stuff.
And he threatens her and then the cops come over.
Finally, after like about 6 or 7 minutes.
Totally. And they get him and they take him to the precinct. And there's just kind of a stupid scene. Actually, one of my favorite scenes. I'll put this on our post and Sam will as well for the Twitter when we release this episode. Because when they're at the precinct, they have a conversation with Cotton, realize they can't hold him for anything. But sitting outside of the office where they're interviewing him is Sydney, her roommate, and
Dewey.
Dewey, yeah. And as Cotton is going over to get his things from the checkout counter, or yeah. whatever you call it, Courtney Cox walks around the corner and starts talking to him. Right next to where she's standing, there's a wall full of pictures. These pictures, I was like, this set decoration is so bad, it must mean something. There must be a clue in these.
I didn't even notice.
I'm going to show this to you. And like I said, everybody, this will be on the
social media posts.
On the social media post when we post it. It's hilarious because I want you to just go ahead and zoom in on that set decoration. What weird fucking nonsense. Sam, describe what you see here.
Yeah, it's basically four stock images where they just cut out the background. So it's like a guy with a weird hat yep. while wearing a, you know, just collared up or collared shirt with a tie, with a baseball cap and no background. It's on white. There's another picture of two police officers shaking hands like you would see in like training, police yep. training or promotional material.
Yeah, sure.
Again, stark white background.
Stark white background.
You see another picture of what could be derived as either two police officers who didn't want to dress up except for their hats
yep.
or train operators that are also shaking hands on a stark white background.
Stark white background.
And then there is a group of six of these train operators, I'll call them, standing for what would be like a holiday photo.
Yeah.
On a stark white background.
Stark white background.
Yeah.
So these clearly, oddly, photoshopped images take up more than half the screen.
Yeah, the frame that I saw right here is Courtney Cox on the left, and her portion is probably 40% of the frame.
Yes.
The other 60 is of these so bizarre, weird
images.
They're
so strange, and they get so much screen time. I was like, what clues are we missing in these?
Yeah, I honestly, I didn't remember until you showed me. And I said, oh, yeah, I actually made a mental note of that was just weird looking stuff.
Fucking weird. These pictures with the weird people cut out of them on a stark white background are the photographic equivalent of a ransom letter, where you cut out letters from other newspapers and magazines and paste them onto a white piece of paper.
Yeah.
Surreptitiously kind of like scattered about.
Yep.
In a weird manic manner. I just need to point that out. I don't know. I may cut this out because it's obviously more visual than audio, but it is fucking weird. And I don't know who did set deck on this movie, but I was like, you fired. You fucking fired.
Yeah, that's one bit where they did not do well.
Okay. So once again, in light of all the shit that's going on, there's a campus lockdown, not unlike the curfew in the first movie.
Yep.
So even though there's that, we've got Dewey and Courtney Cox, they have a conversation outside the precinct or whatever the fuck this is. Joel goes, peace, I'm out. He goes to a cab. That's the cab.
Yeah, it was at this point in the movie where I said it's really kind of weird. Like there, at this point, there hasn't been a ton of killing.
No.
3-4 people, very spread out.
Yeah.
And it's really more about the changing character dynamics and relationships between all these people.
Yeah.
With a little killing in it. Now, the second half of this movie, or from here on out, very much tries to make up for that.
Sure.
But it's just one of the weird things. The pacing is a little strange.
Yeah, it's super strange. And so this scene is just to show that Courtney Cox and Dewey kind of make up. And they also realize that there's they also make out. There's a lot of B-roll that they need to watch because they're like, oh, if the guy could see us on the quad, he must be standing on the quad. He must be in one of these videos that our camera operator that just dipped. He must have captured him.
Right.
So all of a sudden, snap. It's dark outside.
Yeah.
They run to the film school.
Just a random open classroom with a TV on the desk and a VCR.
Yeah. So they start watching it and whatever. And all of a sudden, a big ass CRT monitor behind.
A second CRT monitor. Which did not look like it was in the shot when they showed to establish this room.
Right.
But maybe I'm incorrect.
No. So all of a sudden that comes on. But you're seeing footage of not of the actual murders, but around the place and the time of the murders that could have only been captured by the person that actually did the murders.
Right. Because you see the shot, like a shot of Sarah Michelle Gellar standing on the front porch. And then eventually it cuts to a live shot of the two of them, which I don't think you could. I don't know how they've got this place wired. I don't know that you could do this in 1997, but at least not in the way presented. Nowadays, it'd be easy as hell.
Sure.
But then I don't know how easy that would have been.
Yeah, because then you realize that Ghostface is up in the
projection room,
essentially. And it was at this point because, you know, suspicion has been cast upon everybody in this movie.
Right.
But I was like, OK, it's obviously Timothy Oliphant. It's all about he's like,
you know, who disappeared from this movie at this point?
Timothy Oliphant. He disappeared. And now we're seeing the Ghostface has all of this like tech savvy and video camera equipment and is really into filming people.
He was also shown. Yeah, exactly. He was shown carrying a camcorder around throughout most of his parts of the movie.
Exactly. So I'm like, well, duh, obviously.
Yep.
So that's like whatever.
And that part honestly makes sense for what he says later on when he's revealed.
Does it?
We'll come to it when we get more into that part.
Okay, you can defend that statement.
But I defend Timothy Oliphant being the killer or a killer. The other one, I think, does not work.
Oh, see, I think the inverse.
Oh, see, really? You think, okay, we'll get there. So anyway, we've got scene. He's chasing around Dewey and, you know, Courtney Cox. She goes into a sound studio away from them. You know, Ghostface goes into the room, can't get her because she locks herself in the sound, the control room.
Mm-hmm.
Dewey comes into the room, not knowing Ghostface is in there.
Right.
Dewey gets stabbed in front of her, presumably killed.
Yep.
And then she manages to make her way out of there because Ghostface apparently just leaves.
Yeah.
And she finds Cotton in the hallway who's got bloody hands.
Exactly.
And so she runs out and freaks out thinking that it is, you know, Cotton that's the killer.
Mm-hmm. And who does she run into making a phone call?
Laurie Metcalf.
She grabs a phone from Laurie Metcalf and she goes, it's Cotton fucking Weary.
Yeah.
Cotton Weary? Cotton
no,
Mather.
She says Cotton fucking
Cotton
Weary.
Cotton Weary. Cotton Mather is like a... Wasn't he like a... religious figure in history?
What was the name again?
Cotton Mather. Isn't that right?
Maybe, but I don't know it. But Cotton Weary is the name in this movie.
Cotton Weary. Yeah, Cotton. So anyway, in the meantime, Sydney and her roommate are getting taken by the police from 1978 into a police car from 1978 because they're going to go stay at, like, I don't know, a safe house or something like that.
I guess.
So they're in this police car that is like an unmarked police car, but still has the gate up where the backseat is partitioned off.
And apparently the child locks where they can't get out.
Exactly.
Which is stupid.
Well, that's what cop cars do.
Yeah, but you think you could disable that considering these people are not under, you know.
Oh, maybe.
Because child locks prevent people from getting out, not preventing people from getting in.
Right. So anyway, they're in the car and they drive down the street and
Ghostface shows up randomly with no reason or rhyme to know that she is there being taken here. There's no explanations to how he can be there.
No. In the meantime, in a really quick little scene that was completely pointless, which is before she and roommate got into the car, fat kid from Stand By Me shows up and says a goodbye. And I'm like, didn't you fucking break up? Why does this guy keep popping up?
Yeah.
And his Greek brothers run up to him and they're like, oh, you gave away your letters. Now we're going to do some Greek
totally
shit
pointless.
With you. It was totally pointless. Very stupid. They drag him away. They end up having a party at the theater.
Right. And they tie him up to one of the pieces of the one
this,
of the decorations.
Like, Christ-like figure thing. Right.
And just spray beer and mark on him with markers. That's really stupid.
Yeah, it's super weird. So anyway, back to the cop car. Ghostface is there. He kills one of the cops. The other cop gets out of the car. Ghostface gets in the driver's seat, drives off.
No, drives off and hits the cop, who at this point has seen his partner murdered, a police officer, and is still saying, stop the car, stop. No, you start shooting into that car.
If they knew it was a black guy, I guess how many shots would have already been fired?
That did cross my mind. Yep. I'm like, oh, if you knew that, if you thought that was a black guy, you'd have been firing away.
Exactly. But of course he does not.
No, he does not.
He's a bumbling cop.
Yeah, he is a bumbling, inept cop. Because it's like Ghostface is smashing a bunch of stuff with the car, traffic partitions, whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
But the cop is securely on the hood of the vehicle.
Yeah.
He could
shoot.
Like he's on the left side of the hood looking at the car. He's on the left side of the hood with the gun in his right hand. So he has got a very clear firing line to Ghostface.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no reason why he couldn't have half a clip into this guy.
Yes. Except for stupid movie, dumb logic.
Right. So essentially, Ghostface smashes into a pile of rebar, which goes through the cop's head, which is probably the most grotesque kill in this movie. But they don't even show you that much of it.
No.
It's mostly kind of subtext.
It is subtext. All you see is that...
you see one side shot of the bar kind of going into his head.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it is just veiled
shots. Well, they pan
shots.
Down, his hand twitches, and he drops his gun.
Right.
Got to see that part.
Yeah.
And then this part, which was so infuriating, and I'm sure it's fun horror movie shit, which is, you know, the girls are trapped in the back, right? Because they're in the back of this cop car. There's a gate and all this shit or whatever. Ghostface is presumably knocked out in the front.
Right.
Because she says he's still breathing. I'm like, bitch, how do you fucking tell that? You can't tell that. Like,
unless you get to hear him through the mask.
And they're
I mean,
also
they
talking
get pretty close.
So loudly.
Yeah.
Like, is he dead? And she's like, I don't think so. And then he looks at the cop and she's like, is he dead? And she's like, I think so. And I'm like, ugh, I wish this was funnier than it was. So what ends up happening is they have to rip down the gate and
climb over Ghostface to get out the open window.
Over passed out Ghostface, who is in the driver's seat, through the window because the door won't unlock even from the inside.
Yeah, I'm assuming the accident busted up the mechanism.
So both girls get out. They go to run away. And I start yelling in my notes
get
and
the
at the
gun
TV.
Because you showed us and Sydney would have seen the gun.
Get the gun.
Shoot the guy.
Take anything.
Because there is busted up wood, construction equipment,
rebar.
Any number of things that she could have grabbed and beaten the tar out of
That's
this
what
guy
I'm saying.
With.
Kill him. Hit him. Even if you don't, whatever, you know he's dead or not, whatever. Or take his mask off because she attempts to and then she doesn't and the whatever.
It's the horn and it's stupid.
It's so stupid. It's like just meant to heighten the situation.
Right.
They run 30 feet away. She goes, I got to know who it is. And I'm like, well, duh. And also, why don't you whatever. It's so stupid.
It's a stupid part.
So stupid. She goes back and he's gone. And then whoops, he shows up and then kills the roommate. Obviously.
Yeah.
She's a black woman. She's got to die.
Oh, yeah. It was she had the death clock going from the moment she showed up.
From the second she showed up and had no personality.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. She is out.
So Sydney runs away. hears music coming from her theater. So I assume that she thought people were in there. So she's going in there for help. That's the only reason I could think of that she went in that building when you could have gone anywhere else.
Thank you.
To set up the finale.
So I'm so glad that you said that because I was like, bitch, don't go in there.
Yeah.
I was like, bitch, they're playing creepy music. Why are you doing this?
Yeah. It took me a minute to piece it together why she went in the building.
You're smart.
I mean, I'm not. The music from the outside because she notices it and she goes in. So my assumption was that she went in there thinking they were doing a rehearsal or something and she could get help.
You're correct, because she comes in and she goes, hello. Like, she's yelling and making herself known, and she yells Gus, which is presumably the name of David Warner. She goes down to the stage. A spotlight comes on her, like expected.
Of course.
Obviously. And drops down from the ceiling is Fat Kid from Stand By Me, Jerry O'Connell. And I only call him Fat Kid from Stand By Me because
he closes her in on the set, you dropping other pieces of.
Yeah. And I'm like, you could walk off the front, you dumb bitch.
Right.
There are stairs that you walked up to get up there.
There are ways to get out of this.
So anyway, so dumb. So anyway, he's lower down. And like I said, I only call him Fat Kid from Stand By Me because that's how he refers to himself in interviews. And I think it's kind of funny.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So Jerry O'Connell is lower down. And all of a sudden, Ghostface pops up, and then we get the reveal.
It is the least surprising reveal since Skeet Ulrich in the first one.
Exactly.
It's Timothy Olyphant, or not Jamie Kennedy.
Not Jamie Kennedy.
I mean, you knew it was him for reasons that we'd already mentioned.
Yes.
The camcorder, the fact that he disappears for over half the movie.
Yeah.
One thing or another. So he, of course, goes into his monologue about why he's doing all this.
Well, at first he tries to say that Jerry O'Connell is his partner and helped
him.
Oh,
that's right.
Because she's trying to help him down, and he goes, hey, buddy, you can't help me if you're stuck up there. We've been doing this together. So now it's like, do you believe the killer or do you believe the boyfriend? The boyfriend who has proven in previous movies to not be trustworthy because he actually was the killer.
Right.
So she doesn't know what to do. And I remember this from seeing it. The two scenes I remember, one, her in caller ID. Two, the second scene I remember from 1997 is Timothy Olyphant shoots Jerry O'Connell in the chest.
Yes.
And she covers up his wound and slaps it and goes, and it's the most comical thing I've ever seen in my life. She just slaps him right in the chest.
I'm sure that feels great as the life drains out of him.
Also, he's going, the sound effect, it just like is so funny. It's not like putting pressure on a wound when somebody has been shot in like a more dramatic movie. Right. It was so fucking funny. So anyway, we know that he's dead. Sorry, dude. You lost another boyfriend.
Sorry, Jerry.
So there's a lot of conversation, right? He's like, they have some like.
He goes into the thing he mentions, or the kind of motive, is in the first movie, they were trying to get away with it. This movie, he wants to get caught. He wants to go on trial. He wants to prove that movies made him do it. Which was seated in the very first scene that he's in the classroom where they're having the discussion about Stab, the movie, because the killings had just happened at the theater. So, and of course, there is the meta nature of being a sequel that Jamie Kennedy lays out the rules. That made sense thematically with what had been going on in the movie. And I think it works for what the movie is, or at least for the most part, what it was. That was a lot better in terms of a motivation than what happens next.
So alternately, this is around the time when there's been a lot of hubbub about movies and violence and video games making people behave in that manner.
Yes.
Blaming young children.
It was very much of the time. It was very much a talking point.
It was a talking point. And so he's like, I want to prove that that is correct.
It was also a commentary on trials, murder trials as entertainment, because this was only several years after O.J.
Simpson.
Just
a couple of years after O.J.
There was a lot of commentary going on here, and then it's basically just pulled away and just crapped on.
See, I think that that's why I didn't really like it, because it just seemed like social commentary in a way where I was like, I mean, I get it. I understand it.
Right.
I understand it logically, but as far as like a character motivation, I'm like, so he's just a crazy person who's like, I really do want to get caught and prove that the things.
He's crazy. I mean,
but I think that's why I don't buy it. I'm like, just calling someone crazy shouldn't be the fucking reason. Like, because here's what is revealed. He does have a partner. and the partner is Laurie Metcalf, as
and
we discussed earlier.
I think this sucks.
So
I thought this was a rewrite.
But here's the thing. Laurie Metcalf is proven to be Skeet Ulrich's mom.
Right.
In the first movie, he got butthurt because Sydney's mom and his dad had an affair. And so Skeet's mom, Laurie Metcalf, abandoned him.
Right.
And in this movie, she's like, how dare you kill my son? I'm back to exact revenge on you. In Friday the 13th, Jason is not the killer.
Right.
It is Jason's mother.
As mentioned in the beginning of Scream.
That kills the people that she thinks are responsible for the death of her son.
Right.
So this is meta commentary on a classic horror movie. To me, this makes more sense than the
To me, this
Timothy
is more
Oliphant
of a meta
thing.
Reference than a commentary. Like, I think
yes,
Timothy's
you're right. It is
Oliphant
a meta reference.
Was more commentary. And considering that a lot of Scream and the more interesting parts of this movie were commentary, I think it was a bit more thematically appropriate.
But so
and
much
Mitch
of it is also just
more
homage to horror movies.
I mean, and that's true.
I think they're both valid in those points where there's the commentary.
Right.
And then there's also just the direct reference to it. And so right. These two characters that are conjoined in this teamwork are representing those two sides of it.
Right.
I personally didn't like it. I wasn't like, oh, I mean, it was on the nose. We get it. You know, like, because also, why was her character even introduced? Because really, she's just there and keeps running into Courtney Cox.
Right.
And she seems like a very sweet local police reporter, sweet local
beat reporter.
And so anyway, you get that reveal. And so
I think it should have been, I think Metcalf, like the other killer should have been the black camera guy.
So, but why would he have done it though?
I mean, you could always make up maybe these two knew each other from, since you're dumping exposition at this point in terms of motivation, maybe him and Crazy Mitch, I think that was the character's name.
Who?
Oliphant.
Oh, yeah.
I think his character's name was
Mickey.
Mitch. Oh, was it Mickey?
Yeah, it was
Mitch.
Mickey.
Oh,
sorry.
I wrote Mitch. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you could say that they knew each other from far back, and they had planned to do something like this to instigate all of this commotion, maybe, you could right away into it and then have the, you know, kind of racial subversion of the black guy didn't get killed. Right. The black guy was the
now,
killer.
That I do like. I'm just wondering what the character reason would be for it.
You could easily connect those two.
But I do.
Considering there's virtually no, they basically say that Billy's mom.
We met in a chat room.
Yeah, that's basically the connection. You could do something better than that.
It's extremely tenuous.
That's my vote. Black guy and Mickey are the killers, and it should have been the killers in my
mind.
So
there are those two guys. Now, perhaps that was actually in the original screenplay that got leaked. So what the note mentions is it says that the original script, the 42 pages that had been developed, which involved four different killers.
That would have been too much.
Derek, Hallie, Cotton, and Mrs. Loomis. Who is Derek?
And who's Hallie? Is Hallie the roommate?
Derek is Jerry O'Connell, the boyfriend. Hallie.
Is that the roommate?
Is that her name?
I don't know.
Just kept calling her by her actual name.
Yeah, I don't know.
So maybe it's the boyfriend, the roommate,
Cotton,
and
there,
Mrs.
Right?
Loomis. I don't know what that script would have been like.
Yeah, that sounds like it would have been a mess. And Cotton being the killer doesn't make sense.
Not unless he's just like, I really do. He's still attention seeking, and I can for sure do that by thinking I can get away with it because I already got off for that one murder. I've already seen how this plays out, so I can execute it again.
Yeah, maybe.
Perhaps. Or sets himself up to be the hero. He kills all these people, and at the end, he's the hero. He shoots. Like,
okay, you know what? You could have written that.
Yeah. So anyway, obviously, Timothy Oliphant and Laurie Metcalf met in a chat room.
She basically groomed him to be a psycho killer.
Totally. And then she shoots him.
Yeah, which, I mean... What a waste.
Why?
What a complete waste.
Why?
Yeah.
I just...
This finale completely falls apart for me.
I don't understand the logic behind that. I don't.
Right.
It was truly stupid. So she's explaining herself, who she is, what happened. And she's like, and I did like the fact that it's not just a reference to Friday the 13th and Mrs. Voorhees.
Right.
Right. Which is overt. Right. But her son was killed by Sydney.
Right.
Sydney's mom, the slutty neighbor woman,
right,
is the reason why she even had to get divorced and leave anyway. So there's a lot of interactions. Their families are intertwined. That level to it I was like, ooh, drama. Like,
on a personal level, it makes sense. Exactly. But considering, I don't know, just the overall nature of the franchise, I think the meta nature of, you know, Oliphant's argument fit better with what the series was doing.
I don't know. I think you're liking it from like this like macro commentary
That's
level
true.
And I'm liking it from like character motivation level.
Right. It's so also fairly unoriginal though, in terms of you killed my son, now I want revenge.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. It's an understandable motivation, right. But it's not exactly,
I mean,
unique.
It's on the nose. I just think that it does fit to me. I think that is airtight, and it also references the first movie because that's why he's pissed, right?
And I also think, because I mean, every interaction that Laurie Metcalf has with the other characters is just totally innocent. There's nothing
right
to make us think, other than the fact that she's there
and she should,
that,
yeah,
you know, she could have done something.
Right.
Like, there is no line of dialogue, no camera shot, no musical cue that gives us any reason to believe
right
that she had anything to do with any of this. So it feels like just a random last minute swerve.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you have to consider, and, you know, we said this about the first movie where it's like, why were they even throwing suspicion onto Sydney's dad, a guy that got 30 seconds of screen time?
Right.
By the logic of all movies, it wouldn't make sense for him to be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, you're like, but hold on, why is she even introduced? Because she's not doing anything and they're
right
not casting suspicion on her. She has no active role in this movie.
Yeah.
So she has to be something. Now, you're right. They should have actually had a few scenes where she seems suspicious, you know?
Right. Maybe she's talking with the other reporters and like, hey, you got any kids? And she could do some sort
exactly
of line like that.
That's a great scene.
You know, something yeah like that.
She skirts the issue or like makes reference to Woodsboro, where they're from, or something
right
like that, you know? Yeah, that would have made more sense and I think layered it in a little bit more. So anyway, what happens is they're having some fights and stuff. She's holding a knife. The gun gets knocked away, or there are two guns.
There were two guns. One that Timothy Oliphant got off the cop, and I guess Laurie Metcalf just had one.
Bitches are spacking. But her gun gets knocked away. She's holding a knife to Sydney as Cotton Mather pops in.
Cotton Weary.
Cotton Mather. And now we
neglected that Courtney Cox was in the scene, but all she does is run across the stage and get shot and fall off.
Yeah, that's all it does.
Like, she doesn't do anything.
No, she falls into the orchestra pit.
The way they shoot her entrance is to make you think for a split second that she's the other killer.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's quickly dismissed.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, because she wanders in with Laurie Metcalf because she had run into Laurie Metcalf at the phone booth.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, got it.
Yeah, so they set up the finale. So Courtney mm-hmm Cox is off the stage.
Now there's a standoff because Cotton has come in. He's picked up one of the guns. Laurie is holding a knife to Sydney, and each of the women is trying to convince him to kill the other.
Right.
Like, kill Sydney because she won't give you what you want. And she's like, kill
her. Also, she put you in prison for a year, which again,
1 year.
1 year.
Yeah. And, you know, and she's like, obviously she's a fucking killer. Look at this killer. And you think that he's going to lean toward killing Sydney until Sydney gives him what she wants. And she goes, done, I'll do the interview. And so then he shoots Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah. And then they do the subversion. Mm-hmm. Well, Courtney Cox is alive, so she comes back on stage.
Okay, fine. Whatever.
They get both guns. The girls have the guns. And they're standing over Laurie Metcalf. And they're like, oh, you think he's dead? And of course, you know, Nev's like, well, they always come back.
Yep.
And then Mickey jumps up like a cartoon character, flailing his arms like Kermit the Frog
yep
on meth.
Absolutely.
And they turn and this riddle him full
unload
of bullets and he flies
him
back like 16 feet like a true cartoon character should. And, you know, then Sydney just turns and puts one in Laurie Metcalf's head just to make sure.
Yes.
And then that's it.
And then that's basically the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I will say this.
Dewey lives.
I think we knew he was going to, because we knew there was going to be a third one because they already referenced a franchise.
That's true.
So Courtney Cox lives, Dewey lives, Sydney lives.
Yes.
One thing, and again, I'll also put this up on the Twitter and the Instagram, looking down at Laurie Metcalf's face. Sam, I'm going to show you a picture.
I mean, she looked kind of...
Who does she look like? The dead kid from Stand By Me. Tell me that those
wow
two dumb faces don't look exactly the fucking same.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So,
one of those happy accidents.
Right? It's the crossed eyes and the eyes are too close together and the blood in the nose.
Yeah.
Guys, this has been a very visual podcast. I can't wait for you to see how right I am.
Yeah.
So ties it back to Stand By Me and Jerry O'Connell.
Exactly.
We've another got movie lots that we've done references. On this podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. We're inadvertently killing it with the cross promotion.
Absolutely. Anyway, there's also just one last note. There's a lot of super 90s music in
this.
Oh
my gosh.
There's Everclear at the beginning, Less Than Jake, Collective Soul.
Yeah.
Woof.
As 90s as the first movie is, I think this movie outdoes it in that regard.
And it also does mention like 90s. Like I'm not. Oh, yeah. Because Laurie Metcalf mentions at the end
that his motive is very 90s.
Yes.
But I think it would have worked. I mean,
yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just like the Laurie Metcalf spin.
Yeah. See, I didn't. And her shooting it makes no sense because it's not her objective of killing Sydney contrasted or was in opposition to his goal of getting a big media trial.
Yeah, totally.
So there was just pointless.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that part was very dumb. But all right. Last looks. Like it, didn't. What do you think?
I mean, it's fine. I mean, like I said, this is the second half is a very just mixed bag of missed potential.
Yeah.
I obviously think they should have gone in one thematic direction that you didn't. But unless you're marathoning the series, I don't think you need to watch this one. The first one is very much a cultural touchstone. This one, not so much.
I think perhaps watch this one in the same way. I mean, like there were a couple of parts that I was pleased by. Again, I enjoy Jamie Kennedy in it.
Right.
It was really ham-fisted with a lot of the meta narrative on the first half. Right. Mm-hmm. I did love all of the insane 90s cameos that made me very, very happy. I think maybe if you're going to binge this series, watch it because it makes you appreciate how good the first one actually is.
Right.
Yeah. So our top five other characters that should have been the killers that weren't these killers. The two cop cars. Joel, the camera guy, and Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah.
I think Jamie Kennedy could have snapped and done it.
Would have
been expected, but sure.
Right. I don't know if we have two other
sets. I don't
know if
we have any other characters.
Yeah, I think those. I mean, you could have written it to where Cotton Weary did it, but that would have been a pretty substantial.
Well, I don't know. Like we said, it could have been that he's still wanting media attention. And he's like, I know how to get away with it. I saw these bumbling idiots and what they did and how they didn't execute it correctly. And he's already kind of been proven innocent for doing it. So I think Cotton could have been a fourth one.
Yeah, that's possible.
So our fifth one is Sydney actually does it. And it's all
why the hell not?
I mean, it could be like American Psycho and it happens all in her mind or something like that.
Right.
That brings us finally to the second and final segment of the show, the pitches.
The pitches.
This is the portion of the show where one of us, this week it's me, will pitch to Sam three television shows this week because we know next week we will be watching Scream 3. Scream 3.
FMAS 3.
So if this was Scream Louder, is that when Scream Loudest? Scream More?
Give me a week to think about it.
Okay, we'll come back. Oh, top five names for these movies instead of Scream 1, 2, and 3.
And 4, which we're not going to watch.
4, and then if there was a fifth one, what would we call it?
I guess the fourth one is technically Scriforum, because they put the 4 into the word.
Did they really?
They did.
Like in 7?
Yeah.
Yeah. That, which is also 1995, so around
7
this movie.
N.
Yeah. Funny. It's a 7N. Okay. So, like I said, because we know what we're going to watch next week, Scream 3. I'm going to pitch to Sam three television shows. Sam, are you ready?
Yeah, but don't make any of them Lizzie McGuire.
I can tell you off the bat, they are not.
Okay.
No, Lizzie. It'd be funny if I was just like, what you said last week. All right. Pitch number one. A single father attempts to connect with his son, only to find himself wrapped up in a feverish fight with his ex. But a long hidden secret shared between the two parents strengthens their relationship.
Okay.
Number two, in an homage to the greatest, to the Queen Bee, this Emmy-nominated scorned lover confronts their man, while their quirky roommate contemplates college with America's favorite fighting Frenchman.
Okay.
Number three, ladies, we've all been the victim of a shame-inducing, anger-building, embarrassment-laden bad haircut. Ridicule and speculation, though, can't keep down a true leader as humor wins the day and everyone gets what they deserve.
All right. So the first one is very kind of generic.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't really have any guesses here. I'm assuming, perhaps most likely and correctly, that these are all throwback TV shows.
Okay. Do you want me to reread them?
Sure. Why not?
Okay. Number one. A single father attempts to connect with his son, only to find himself wrapped up in a feverish fight with his ex. But a long-hidden secret shared between these two parents strengthens their relationship.
Okay.
Number two. In an homage to the greatest, to the Queen Bee, this Emmy-nominated scorned lover confronts their man while their quirky roommate contemplates college with America's favorite fighting Frenchman.
Okay.
Number three. Ladies, we've all been the victim of a shame-inducing, anger-building, embarrassment-laden bad haircut. Ridicule and speculation, though, can't keep down a true leader as humor wins the day and everyone gets what they deserve.
For some reason, I feel like the third one's a sitcom. Do I know which one? Hell no.
I know. It's hard with these TV. I mean, there's just so much TV, right?
Exactly.
So which one?
I mean, just considering the Courtney Cox connection, part of me thinks that you just chose an episode of Friends for the third one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's incorrect.
Got it.
I am tripping over my mind trying to figure out America's favorite fighting Frenchman.
Okay.
For whatever reason, Jean-Claude Van Damme is jumping into my head. But first of all, he never did TV. Second of all, he's not French. He's from Brussels.
Yeah. The muscles from Brussels.
The muscles from Brussels.
Are there any that right off the top you're like, I'm not interested in that?
The first one is a little, like I said, generic.
Yeah.
I mean, you can make that any number of different TV shows. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go with B.
B. In an homage to the greatest, the Queen Bee, this Emmy-nominated scorned lover confronts their man while their quirky roommate contemplates college with America's favorite fighting Frenchman, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Kimmy's roommate, Lemonades. Season 3, Episode 2.
Okay, I have never seen any of this show. So
I figured you hadn't, so that's why I threw it in
here.
So knowing that it is Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I'm going to tell you what the other episodes are, and then I will tell you what the theme is.
Okay.
The first one, about the single father and the ex, Will and Grace, episode called Dying is Easy, Comedy is Hard, season 4, episode 15.
Okay.
Number three.
Definitely didn't watch enough Will and Grace to be able to recognize
that. Well, I wrote it rather ambiguously, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Number three, about the bad haircut and humor, Powerpuff Girls, the main event, season 3, episode 2.
Oh,
all of these movies.
Nice. TV shows.
All of these TV shows, not unlike this movie with red hair, streaky hair from Courtney Cox, all have red haired characters and all are about haircuts or something to do with hair.
Oh. Okay.
So the first one, Will and Grace.
Nice pull.
Thank you. The first one, Jack, is one of the characters. He is a son, and he, I think it's a son's idea to bleach his hair. And so then the mom gets upset with him. And then it comes to be revealed because Jack is gay in the show.
Right.
And he doesn't know this, but it turns out the mother of his son is also gay. And so they share this kind of moment where they understand each other. So Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt,
I know the general concept of the show.
Yeah, it's great. You probably won't like it. I know you don't care for Tina Fey and her comedy. It's super wacky.
Was she involved in that one?
Yeah, dude, she created it.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Okay, so you're going to hate this. But
probably.
Ellie Kemper obviously has red hair.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit of a loose connection, but in this episode, Tytus Burgess has a direct homage to Beyonce's Lemonade.
Ah.
And in Lemonade, there's a reference to Becky with the good hair.
Gotcha.
And number three.
Six Ways to Kevin Bacon.
There you go.
Which is also referenced in Scream 2.
There you go. Oh, is it?
Yes.
Which part?
By one of the sorority girls.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's right. Number three, the Powerpuff Girls, basically Blossom with the red hair. Her hair gets cut and messed up.
Ah, okay.
And so the other girls also, their hair gets messed up. So that's what it is. So next week, as an amuse-bouche to Scream 3, we will be watching Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the episode called Kimmy's Roommate Lemonades, season 3, episode 2. And then we will watch Scream 3.
Scream 3, and then I'll pitch, another movie.
So if you like this episode, if you like this show, that's great. Why don't you go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review? It is actually very helpful. Thank you very much. If you leave us a nice review, we will give you a shout out on the show just for
yes.
fun. Yes. Yes. And we'll make that noise too. Yes.
We'll do our best Marv Albert impression.
If you would like to find us on Instagram, you can find us at Storage Room Movie Boom, on Twitter at Storage Room Pod, and you can send us an OG email at storageroompod@gmail.com.
Huzzah!
Goodbye.
All right, bye.